G'day, mate. Luke Ford here. I thought I'd talk about conspiracy theories. I've read probably over 20 books on the JFK assassination. 80% of them were various conspiracy theories. So I've certainly spent my time in that world. Open question, conspiracy theories for losers. That's the title of this talk at the Center for Inquiry. So the Center for Inquiry is aligned with Prometheus Books Publishers. It's an atheist press. Center for Inquiry is like a skeptical group, atheist group, and Prometheus Books published my first book, and I also spoke right here at this Center for Inquiry. So let's listen to a little bit of this conversation.
What I mean by that is not pejorative. I mean a descriptive term. So people who are on the outside, people who have lost, people who are at the bottom of a power asymmetry or perceive themselves to be under threat. So I don't want to insult any conspiracy theorists. But even when I put that on it, they get insulted anyway. Follow me on Twitter, not to hear what I say, but to see what they say. It's very entertaining. Okay, so there are two things my mother told me never to talk about, politics and religion. I'm a political science professor, so I didn't listen to her. And
yes, I spoke there.
A third thing I would add to that list is conspiracy theories. If you don't believe me, at Thanksgiving, when you're with your extended family, wait for a few bottles of wine to go down, then bring up a few of your favorite conspiracy theories to that list and then see what happens. If you're not invited back next year, then I'm right. So these ideas can be very difficult to talk about, and the reason is because they touch on things that we care about, truth and power. So for that reason, I try to stay as close to the data as possible, and I'm an equal opportunity offender. I don't think I'm going to offend anyone talking about conspiracy theories or religion in this room. I might offend a few people's political sensibilities, but just know that I like to punch both sides equally hard, and I do it because that's what the data tells me to do and for no other reason. So where does my data come from? From national and statewide surveys I've been collecting for about 7 years now. When I first got into the conspiracy theory thing, there wasn't a lot of data out there. And to study it over time, there weren't surveys that had been repeated over time. So I couldn't really get good overtime measures. So in lieu of that, we turned to letters to the editor of the New York Times, and we got 1,000 letters per year over 120 years. So we got about 120,000 plus letters. I made my research assistants read them all and pick out all the ones that had conspiracy theories in them, and that's what my assistants looked like by the time they were done. And we were able from that to get a whole bunch of letters about different conspiracy theories. And also, I've been collecting Google alerts, so I know what's going on in the news with conspiracy theories. And I'll tell you one interesting thing about our times right now. I started doing this Google alert about 7 years ago. And I used to get 5 or 6 news stories a day coming in with the term conspiracy or conspiracy theories in it. Now it's about 100 a day, and it's been that way for more than a year. So this is a major topic of discussion, and it's a major part of our politics. And I want to explain why that is in the time I have remaining.
So I just bought this book by Michael Shermer, Conspiracies and Conspiracy Theories, What We Should Believe and What We Shouldn't Believe. So let me just play a little bit here on the JFK assassination.
In response, President Lyndon Johnson assembled a blue ribbon commission of investigators headed.
Oh, come on, let me. Okay, let me cue it up here. Lecture 8, Truthers, Lecture 9. Here we go.
Unhappy consequences of McCarthyism would not have come about had the American people rejected his conspiracy thesis about the triumph of communism.
So believing in conspiracy has, particularly if they're false, has real-world consequences. It changes how people behave in the real world. That's why this topic's important.
In China. Conspiracies and conspiracy theories are deeply woven into our national fabric.
Okay, so this is from the new Michael Shannon book.
Lecture 9, The JFK Assassination, The Mother of All Conspiracy Theories. On November 22, 1963, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. In response, President Lyndon Johnson assembled a blue ribbon commission of investigators headed by Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren, which produced a comprehensive 889-page report concluding that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. Since then, exhaustive investigations of the assassination have been conducted, including the thorough 1976 House Select Committee on Assassinations, the definitive 1993 book on Oswald by Gerald Posner, Case Closed, and especially Vincent Bugliosi's 2007 encyclopedic tome, Reclaiming History, which addressed every single claim made by JFK conspiracy theorists. All these investigations have corroborated the original finding that Oswald acted alone.
I thought that Bugliosi...
Since Oswald was himself assassinated 2 days after he killed Kennedy, there was no trial and the case was closed until 1969, when New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison put on trial as a co-conspirator a local businessman named Clay Shaw, who was alleged to have links to Oswald. As Garrison was also a JFK assassination conspiracy theorist, he hoped a trial would uncover elements within the U.S. government that had conspired to kill the president. Most likely, he figured, the CIA in cahoots with the military-industrial complex, because Kennedy wanted to get out of Vietnam. In a very real and terrifying sense.
Okay, let me play a little bit from the comic business on the JFK assassination.
I love talking about Kennedy. I was just down in Dallas, Texas. You know, you can go down there and to Dealey Plaza, where Kennedy was assassinated. And you can actually go to the sixth floor of the School Book Depository. It's a museum called the Assassination Museum. I think named that after the assassination. I can't be too sure of the chronology here, but anyway, they have the window set up to look exactly like it did on that day. And it's really accurate, you know, because Oswald's not in it. Yeah, so.
Wow, that's good.
Painstaking accuracy, you know. It's true. It's called a sniper's nest. It's glassed in. It's got the boxes sitting there. And you can't actually get to the window itself. And the reason they did that, of course, they didn't want thousands of American tourists getting there each year going, no fucking way! I can't even see the road! Shit, they're lying to us! Fuck! Where are they? There's no fucking way! Not unless Oswald was hanging by his toes upside down from the ledge. Either that or some pigeons grabbed onto him, flew him over the motorcade. Surely someone would have seen that. You know, there was rumors of anti-Castro pigeons seen drinking in bars. Someone overheard them saying, coo, coo, coo.
Okay. Well, let me go back. I recommend this Michael Shermer book, Conspiracies and Conspiracy Theories, What We Should and Shouldn't
Believe. Garrison proclaimed, our government is the CIA and the Pentagon, with Congress reduced to a debating society. Unfortunately for Garrison, the jury acquitted Shaw in under an hour. Conspiracy theories swirling around the president's assassination arose from day one, but interest was reignited after Watergate eroded public trust in the government in the early 1970s. Then the Zapruder film was made public in 1975, so everyone could see the president's head jolt back and to the left, as if the bullet came from the grassy knoll to the president's right, instead of behind where Oswald was located in the Book Depository building. So in 1976, the government reopened the case when the House Select Committee on Assassinations hired 250 investigators and spent $5.5 million and 30 months to get to the bottom of who really killed JFK. After issuing a colossal 12-volume report, the committee concluded that Oswald was guilty and that no agency within the U.S. government was involved. The only tidbit conspiracy theorists got out of the report was that it concluded a fourth bullet was fired. But that was based on an audio tape from the Dictabelt recording device on one of the police motorcycles in Dealey Plaza, later determined to have happened a full minute after the assassination, after the president's motorcade was gone, and was not even the sound of a gunshot. A decade later, in 1986, London Weekend Television set up a mock trial in which Vincent Bugliosi, famous as the prosecutor who convicted Charles Manson, posthumously tried Lee Harvey Oswald. Oswald was defended in absentia by the equally famous defense attorney, Jerry Spence. After a 20-hour trial, the jury deliberated for 6 hours before convicting Oswald as the lone assassin. Case closed. In the mind of the public, however, the case is still not closed. Polls taken since the mid-1960s have consistently found that at least half of all Americans believe that there was more than one shooter in Dealey Plaza. A 1997 Fox News poll found that a little over half of Americans consider it either very likely or somewhat likely that U.S. officials were directly involved in the president's death. A 2003 ABC News poll found that only 32% of American adults believe Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. A 2006 Gallup poll found that 34% of Americans specifically believe that the CIA was involved. A 2009 CBS News poll reported that between 60 and 80% of Americans said they believe JFK was killed by a cabal of assassins.
Okay, let me go to, this is a discussion with the trauma doctor who was on duty when...
This coming Friday marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. With each passing year, there are fewer eyewitnesses able to share their stories. Some never have in front of a national television audience, including a Texas doctor named Red Duke.
Something has happened in the motorcade route.
President John F. Kennedy was shot at 12:30 p.m. Central Standard Time.
He was wounded in an automobile driving from Dallas Airport into downtown Dallas, along with Governor Connally.
35-year-old fourth-year surgery resident Red Duke was on break at Parkland Memorial Hospital.
I heard the chairman of surgery, Paige Stat. Well, that was unheralded. I went over to answer the phone. Another fellow got there first. I said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "Well, the president's been shot." And I... You know, that's so out of character. I mean, I don't even imagine that sort of thing happening. And I actually, for a moment, thought, well, I'm going to get to meet a president. I've never met one of those.
When Duke arrived outside the emergency room, it didn't take long to appreciate the gravity of the situation.
I saw Mrs. Kennedy with some badly stained clothing, and I thought, ooh, it's not good.
You knew as soon as you saw the president.
Yeah, when you see that kind of wound, you know what it is. But they said, well, the guy across the hall needs some help. I thought, well, I've got as good a chance to help somebody out there as I do here, so I walked over there, and I didn't know who it was. It's the man in the suit.
The man in the suit was Texas Governor John Connally, who also had been shot and who was not being tended to. Red Duke got to work.
Put a chest tube in him and then went through the other maneuvers you have to do to get somebody ready to go to the operating room.
If Governor Connally had not been treated, he would have died.
Yeah, he couldn't do that for very long.
When you think back on that day, does part of it still seem like a dream?
Yeah, it's the surreal thing. Actually, it's kind of an out-of-body thing. You know, that doesn't happen.
Presidential historian and Rice University professor Douglas Brinkley.
Red Duke is a trauma doctor. Well, he was there when our nation went into trauma.
There's only one word to describe the picture here, and that's grief.
And when you think about what the doctors dealt with at their department, they did a great job because Red Duke recognized Kennedy's dead. I got to go work on John Connally. And, of course, Connally not only survived but went on to have decades active in American politics.
Governor Connally and Red Duke also became great friends and lifelong hunting partners. Connally passed in 1993, but Duke still hunts today. He also dabbles in painting, but there's one image he can't bring himself to create on canvas, the roses carried by Jackie Kennedy that he found abandoned.
That's a hard painting. As I walked out of the room, I pulled my gloves off and threw them to a kick basin. And those roses were upside down in that kick basin, and my gloves fell over.
You think about those roses?
Mm-hmm. Did this morning.
When he's not painting, Duke teaches medical students and still treats patients today. At 85, he says he has no plans to retire.
So a few years ago, I read an interesting book called A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. And it's by Philip Shannon. So this is not conspiracy theories. A veteran investigative journalist who spent most of his career at the New York Times. And this book is largely a history of the Warren Commission. He discovered all sorts of information that had been withheld from the Warren Commission by the CIA, the FBI, and other people in power. And in this book, Shannon shows how the commission's 10-month investigation was doomed to fail because the man leading it, Chief Justice Earl Warren, was more committed to protecting the Kennedy family than getting to the full truth of what happened on that tragic day. So Shannon does believe that Lee Harvey Oswald pulled the trigger on the bullets that killed President Kennedy. But what Shannon leaves open is, why did Oswald go to the Cuban embassy in Mexico City just a few weeks before the assassination? What exactly transpired there? So I think that's an excellent question. And this is Philip Shannon speaking on C-SPAN 2 years ago about the latest JFK documents being released.
Phil Shannon is the author of A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination, and here to talk about these pending release of documents concerning JFK's assassination. Good morning.
Good morning.
What are we expected to see released?
Well, we're going to see thousands and thousands of pages of documents released online. It's fascinating that people all around the world are going to see these documents at the same moment. And it's going to be very difficult for weeks, if not months, to really understand what's in there. We understand that these include 3,100 documents about the assassination that have never been seen by the public before, and something like 30,000 other documents that have been released in the past in redacted form with material edited out. We're supposed to see them in full, but we still have no word from President Trump about exactly what he's going to allow to be released.
Is it your expectation that everything comes out, or does he have the ability to hold some back?
The only person who has the power to withhold any of these documents. There's a 1992 law that required the release of every document in the government's files relating to the assassination. The only person who can block that is the president. It turns out the president is Donald Trump right now. He has said that he will release all of these files unless there is compelling national security information that has to be withheld. And I think there's a frantic effort at the White House this week by the CIA and the FBI in particular to try to block some of this release.
In your mind, what would classify as a national security concern?
Well, to my mind, I mean, I guess I speak as an historian these days. I think this should all be released. It should have been released years ago. You know, we've been dealing with conspiracy theories now for 54 years. It's really time to put an end to this as best we can. But apparently the argument may be made this week that some of these documents were prepared in the 1990s, involved relatively recent intelligence or law enforcement operations that might still be endangered if these documents were released.
The National Archives holds these. There's a website that you can go to see the documents that already exist and then the pending documents as they come out. Why does it take so long to get us to this point for the release of all this information so many years later?
Well, the story is that in 1991, Oliver Stone produced his film JFK, which produced a million conspiracy theories about the assassination, really kicked up a ruckus. Congress reacted the following year by passing a law that required the release of all documents related to the assassination to try to tamp down some of the conspiracy theories. And as a result of that law in the 1990s, millions of pages of documents were made public. Now, a small handful, about 3,100 documents now, have been held back all these years because agencies like the FBI and the CIA argued that they might somehow endanger national security. But under that law, there was a 25-year deadline, and that 25-year deadline to release everything in full is Thursday.
Phil Shannon, the author of A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination, here to talk about the release of these documents. Information would you like to see come from these documents? Are there still unanswered questions in your mind about what happened?
There are. The material I'm most interested in involves what I've always considered the secret hidden chapter of the Kennedy assassination story, which is it involves Mexico City. It involves a mysterious trip that Lee Harvey Oswald, the assassin, paid to Mexico just several weeks before the assassination, where we know from previously declassified files he met with Cuban spies and Russian spies and other people who at the very height of the Cold War might have wanted to see President Kennedy dead. And we know two other things. One is that Oswald was an avowed Marxist. He was a supporter of Castro's revolution. And the fact that the CIA had Oswald under aggressive surveillance in Mexico City while he was there. In Mexico City, he apparently was talking openly about his intention to kill the president. The question in my mind is, what did the CIA know in real time, weeks before the assassination, about the threat that this man posed?
Does it change the he acted alone narrative then?
It might. It doesn't point to something like a second gunman in Dealey Plaza, but it certainly suggests he may have been in contact with people who may have encouraged him to do this, maybe even offered to help him to do this, or to help after he was able to carry it out. And that is, that leads to the question of whether or not there were accessories to this crime, whether or not there were co-conspirators in this crime.
So when it's released and people go to the website, is this material that the average person could understand, or do you have to have some working knowledge of how this works to kind of even make sense of what's released?
No, and that's why I fear a lot of people are going to be disappointed when they begin to pour through this material. This is government officials writing to other government officials. A lot of this is CIA code names and pseudonyms. Some of it's going to be in foreign languages. Some of it, based on past experience, is going to be illegible. I think it's going to be very hard, even for people who have some background on this, to make sense of these documents for say, weeks or months or even years.
Is it a possibility that the documents can reveal how both the CIA and the FBI performed in this matter when it comes to the lead-up to the assassination and how they reacted afterwards?
So when you put Zapruder film into YouTube, its first prompt is Zapruder film with audio, and people in the chat are saying, have you heard the Zapruder film with audio? The Zapruder film is a silent film. There is no audio. There's no original audio on the Zapruder film.
Absolutely. And I say, I think, the narrative of the Kennedy assassination has changed dramatically over the years, from the idea that Oswald was this pure lone wolf, this delusional young man whose plot to kill Kennedy could never have been foiled. Certainly the FBI and the CIA argued they didn't have the chance to stop it. The story seems to be that actually Oswald may have told other people what he was going to do, may have gotten help in doing what he was going to do. And I think a lot of the documents we're going to see are going to suggest just how much more the CIA and the FBI knew about Lee Harvey Oswald before the assassination.
What are you personally going to do with the information that comes out? Do you plan to revise the book at all, or what's your interest particularly?
Well, if something really rewrites story, as I understand it, I'd be intrigued to try to rewrite some of my book. But I don't think that's going to be the situation. I think we're going to be presented with lots more evidence to show that this cover-up by the CIA and the FBI of what they had known before the assassination, I think we're just going to get new information to bolster that.
Well, Sheena.
New information about the assassination of President John F. Kennedy is being made public for the very first time. The National Archives has released thousands of previously classified documents.
So this is a CBS News report from October 28, 2017.
They describe decades of spying and surveillance, assassination plots, and tension among U.S. intelligence agencies. Some of the files are still being withheld, but President Trump tweeted Friday night that he will allow the release of everything. That doesn't include the names and addresses of living people. Larry Sabato is director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics and author of The Kennedy Half Century. He joins us now. Okay, Larry, we've been dying to know. We've got a chance to go through these. What are the big revelations?
Well, let me caution first, even with a lot of help, some wonderful student help here, we've only been able to get through about one-eighth.
And if you're really interested in the Kennedy assassination, the best book is Reclaiming History, The Assassination of President Kennedy by Vincent Bugliosi. I'll just read a little bit. It's like a 3,000-page book. I'll just read a little bit from page 35. The conspiracy theorists are so outrageously brazen that they tell lies, not just about verifiable documentary evidence, but about clear photographic evidence, knowing that only 1 out of 1,000 of their readers, if that, is in possession of the subject photographs. Robert Groden, the leading photographic expert for the conspiracy proponent, who was the photographic advisor for Oliver Stone's movie JFK, draws a diagram on page 24 of his book High Treason, of Governor Connally seated directly in front of President Kennedy in the presidential limousine, and postulates the remarkable path a bullet coming from behind Kennedy and traveling from right to left would have to take to hit Connally. It's absolute nonsense. It's completely wrong. Connally was not seated directly in front of President Kennedy, but to his left front. Though Kennedy was seated on the extreme right in the back seat of the limousine, Connally was in a jump seat situated a half foot from the right door. At the time Connally was hit, the Zapruder film shows that he was turned to his right. Additionally, the jump seat was 3 inches closer than the back seat. Therefore, because of the alignment of John Connally's body vis-a-vis Kennedy's, it was virtually inevitable that a bullet traveling on a downward trajectory and passing on a straight line through soft tissue in Kennedy's body would go on to strike Connally exactly where it did. So let me just play a little bit more here from...
of the tremendous number of pages and documents and files and memos. So there will be continuing revelations and many more nuggets to come. But I've been struck by a number of things. Some support the idea that Oswald was the lone shooter. Others do not. What supports it that I...
And there's a question in the chat, which conspiracy theories have been proven true? Well, 9/11 was a conspiracy theory by Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. So conspiracy theories certainly happen, and they are often incredibly consequential.
Been able to piece together. I had not realized before I read one of these new documents that Lee Harvey Oswald in the mid-1950s, during President Eisenhower's second term, had threatened President Eisenhower's life. This was not reported to authorities. It was by an acquaintance of his in the military. He said it to that acquaintance and indicated he wanted to see Eisenhower die, and he'd like to be the one to do it because he was an oppressor of poor people. When you look at Oswald's life, you see that there is this strain of violence. He has violent tendencies and expressed them well before November 22nd with other violent activities and threats. So that was interesting to me. Something else that I've always focused on, and many people who've looked at the assassination have, is whether Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby, who of course was the one who killed Lee Harvey Oswald just 2 days after the assassination, did they ever meet? Did they ever know each other? There are so many rumors and tips and calls to police and the FBI in the aftermath of the assassination. They were checked out. I don't know whether all of them were checked out, but they're a goodly number in these particular files. To the best of the police's knowledge and the best of the FBI's knowledge, they did not know each other, and they could never find a circumstance where they could prove they were in the...
Okay, so in the chat, Blatt wants to know, why did President Kennedy rock backward when he was shot from behind? So... on page 315 of his 1993 book, Case Closed, author Gerald Posner wrote, but if the president was struck in the head by a bullet fired from the rear, then why does he jerk so violently backward on the Zapruder film, which recorded the assassination? To most lay people, the rapid backward motion at the moment of the headshot means the president was struck from the front. So when ITEC Optical Systems did a computer enhancement of the Zapruder films for a CBS documentary, discovered that when the bullet, the final of the three fired by Lee Harvey Oswald, the first one completely missed, when the third and final bullet hit JFK, he did jerk forward 2.3 inches, and then he began his movement backward. So why did the president jerk backwards when hit in the back of the head by a bullet fired from behind him? So the bullet destroyed the president's cortex. That caused a neuromuscular spasm that sent neurologic impulses from the brain down the spine to every muscle in the body. The body then stiffens, with the strongest muscles predominating. What are your strongest muscles? They tend to be the muscles of the back and the neck. So that's why when most people encounter a stimulus, their first reaction is to jerk their head back and down and to compress their shoulders and their spine, because these muscles are the strongest. When they are activated by the brain, they automatically contract. So with Alexander technique, we learn about this fear reflex. When this reflex becomes a habit, it tends to lead people to walk around with their head kind of permanently tilted back with the neck and shoulders compressed. So this makes movement as well as emotions and thinking awkward. Freedom comes from letting go of this fight or flight reflex by releasing the tendency to compress the neck and the shoulders and to consciously free the neck and to release the head forward and up, which is what Kennedy should have done when his brains were blown out. He should have freed his neck and just directed his head forward and up with good Alexander technique. So directing your head forward and up is the very opposite of what people do with the fear reflex, which is to tilt the head back and down. Okay, so let's look at Zapruder film 313. This shows the headshot to John F. Kennedy, and I'll pull this up in a second here. So this shot was originally withheld by Life magazine. So there we go. So that shows the headshot to Kennedy, you know, and his brain's blowing out. And if Kennedy had not been wearing a corset, he likely would not have died. But because he was wearing a corset when he got hit, he was stayed upright and instead of slumping to the floor of the car. Then in Zapruder film 335, Connolly is slumped onto his wife's lap. Kennedy, now mortally wounded, leans towards Jackie. So Kennedy now is going to die. After the third shot, there was no way that he could... be saved. So the blob on the side of his head is his head and scalp peeling outward and down. And this frame was originally withheld by editors at Life magazine.
the same room in Dallas at the same time. Those are two things. There are many, many more nuggets that we've been picking up.
It's just so fascinating, Larry, after all these years to get these new details. There's also information about an anonymous tips before the assassination. What are you reading about that?
This one stunned me, and I first learned about it from the British media. The media, both electronic and print, yesterday in Britain, was really obsessed with this one memo that indicated that 25 minutes before President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas at 12:30 p.m. Dallas time, November 22nd, a reporter at the Cambridge News in Cambridge, England, the home of the great Cambridge University, received a telephone call. An anonymous tipster said, almost exactly quoting, you'd better call the U.S. Embassy. There's big news coming out of the United States. Well, of course, the reporter did nothing of the kind until he heard about the assassination. Apparently, he was shaken. MI5, British intelligence, was called in to examine it. They're the ones who fixed the time at 12:05, and they believe the reporter. The reporter was a...
So why was Kennedy wearing a corset? Because he had multiple back surgeries, had a lot of back problems. So really, just like if you throw your back out, often people will wear something around the lower back. And JFK's head never went forward. Yeah, it did. I just read from Case Closed, and I also gave you the page if you want to. You want to look it up, page 315 of the 1993 book by Gerald Posner, Case Closed, and it mentions the CBS documentary when it enhanced the Zapruder film. It showed that JFK's head first jerked forward 2.3 inches and then began his movement backward, because our neck and back muscles here are our strongest muscles. And so when the bullet destroys the president's cortex, that causes a neuromuscular spasm that causes these muscles, the body to stiffen, and the strongest muscles will
a very responsible individual who wasn't inclined to make things up. There was not fake news in that reporter's agenda. Well, if that person knew, then if there has to be a conspiracy, or somebody had to at least know that Oswald was going to do this in advance. Was it a coincidence? Maybe. But that's one of the great coincidences in world history.
When you talk also about foreign affairs and the influence abroad, Fidel Castro, for decades there were rumors that the CIA plotted to assassinate him. What do we know about that? Anything more?
Most of the memos are retreads. That is, we've known for a long time that the CIA and indeed the White House came up with all kinds of ideas to bump Castro off, including a poisoned wetsuit when he went diving, just all kinds of strange things. But I'll tell you one that I had never come across before, and I've checked with others. They'd never heard of it either. This was at the highest levels of the White House, the highest level of aides to President Kennedy, a long memo discussing the idea of having a biological agent injected into insects, dropping them over the crops in Cuba, every place where there was a major crop field, so that the biological agent could destroy the crops. And because people probably would be starving, or at least some people would, it would supposedly spark a popular revolt and overthrow Fidel Castro. That was chilling. Now,
Hey, Gandalf, what do you want to add?
1 second here.
Okay.
I've had enough time to check. No one thinks that they actually carried out this plot, but they were talking about it in some detail, so quite a bit of thought went into it.
It's almost like, Larry, if this was a Hollywood movie, you wouldn't believe that actually happened, or was a potential intelligence effort, maybe.
Exactly.
I want to ask you, though, there's a recent poll. It says 61% of Americans still believe that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone. Do we have anything more about those conspiracy theories?
There are a few things that we found, and we're hoping to find a great deal more in the documents that have been withheld that the president says are coming out by April 26th. Of course, under law, they were supposed to come out by October 26th. But we found a few things. There is some credible testimony that someone accompanied Lee Harvey Oswald on the bus from the United States to Mexico City 7 weeks before the assassination in September 1963. Well, I doubt he would bring a fishing buddy with him. This was 6 days devoted to Oswald trying to get a visa into Cuba and trying to get the Soviet Union to help him do so. He visited both embassies. There are credible reports, even one that J. Edgar Hoover passed along to the Warren Commission, that Oswald openly expressed his desire to kill President Kennedy and his determination to do so, partly because he was angry he wasn't getting the visa. Now, again, did they believe him? Probably not. Oswald was a misfit. He was a sociopath. He would lose complete control at moments. So maybe they just dismissed it as the rantings of a madman. But still, that's an important opening to the Mexico City explanation, which has not been undertaken, I think, in all of these years since the assassination. And the Warren Commission didn't do much investigation of Mexico City because they were afraid, and the president, President Lyndon Johnson, was afraid that it would reveal something about the Soviet Union or the Cubans being involved in the Kennedy assassination, which would potentially have led to nuclear war.
Larry, you know, the CIA decided to hold back some of the documents, and President Trump has said he wants everything to be released. What do you think are in those documents that were held? Is there a way of gauging
very good
evidence
of that?
Well, I think some of the subjects we've just been discussing are probably in those papers. But one thing that I think inevitably is in there is reevaluations by both the CIA and the FBI, not just in the 60s, but in succeeding decades, about the mistakes they made. How did they drop the ball with respect to Lee Harvey Oswald? This was not someone who melted into the crowd. He was a very strange individual, one of just a handful of Americans.
Okay, let me go to this other document.
It was now that Abraham Zapruder pressed the trigger on his 8mm cine camera. Ever since that moment,
to assassinate Fidel Castro, if there's such a difference, you're not supposed to have anything to do with each other. But in essence, the remark is really they're all in bed together. They all do business together.
It was now that Abraham Zapruder pressed the trigger on his 8mm cine camera. Ever since that moment, the world has accepted that what he recorded was the definitive account of what really happened. What people must appreciate is that what they have just seen is not at all what really happened. Had you actually been there on the day, this is what you would have seen. Doesn't that look a great deal more suspicious? So just exactly what did happen during the 10 seconds that Zapruder was filming? To begin with, Dulles, Lansdale, and Attlee Phillips had tried to get over the problem of volley fire, blowing the president's head clean off, by firing in four stages. Stage one was meant to be a single shot by Charles Nicoletti into the back of Kennedy's head from the Daltex...
Okay, this is just pure nonsense. This is just... absolute nonsense. If people want the full breakdown on this, they should read Vincent Bugliosi's book. So let's have a look here. Google Images. So this is about the back and left myth.
When you stop to think about it, no one saw anyone with a gun, rifle, on the grassy knoll. No expended cartridges from a weapon were found there. Not one bullet, other than those fired from Oswald's rifle, has ever been found and linked to the assassination. Unless the laws of physics were not working that day, the reaction of the president tells us where that shot came from.
Some critics say by the very fact that in the picture you can clearly see the explosion of the bullet on the front side of the president, that certainly indicates the bullet came from the front.
Well, I don't believe any physicist has ever said that. Quite contrary, it does indicate that the bullet was coming from behind. It's a minor explosion where pieces of material go generally in the direction of the bullet.
If you look at the individual frames of the Zapruder film, at 312, frame 312, president's head's okay. At frame 313, 1/18th of a second later, the president is struck in the head. In what direction is the president's head push? Not backwards, but slightly forward.
Is there any doubt that the wound at the back of the president's head was the entry wound? There is absolutely no doubt, sir.
So at the all-important moment of impact, the president's head is pushed forward, indicating a shot from the rear where Lee Harvey Oswald was.
It is in the famous Zapruder film that we have immutable evidence
a record that is unchanging over the years. It showed us then, and it shows us now. President Kennedy, alive and vibrant in one instant, and mortally wounded in another. In 1975, I questioned experts about what the film was able to reveal. CBS News asked iTech Corporation, world-renowned for film analysis, to study the film scientifically, using the best modern techniques and equipment. It is important to remember that iTech had, for this first-time-ever study, not copies of the Zapruder film, but the original. According to John Wolfe, president of iTech's Optical Systems Division, this is what they found. When the fatal bullet struck, the president's head went forward with extreme speed, almost twice as rapidly, and it subsequently traveled backwards.
So in the three frames following 313, he reversed his direction and came back to where he was before. It took him three frames to do it, so he's moving considerably slower coming back than he moved forward.
No matter how many times you look at it, that's not the impression that one gets just sitting in a room and looking at the film. The very clear impression is that his head jolts backward faster than it went forward.
That, of course, is the whole point of doing this kind of, applying this kind of technique, is to get away from the subjective impressions that are developed by looking at a blurred motion picture. My answer to your implied question is, I don't know what I see, I know what I measure.
What iTech measured in head movements is an important indication that the fatal shot struck President Kennedy from behind. That's point one. Now point two. Computer analysis shows that all major particles from the president's head traveled away from him, forward. Another strong indication that the fatal shot came from the back.
Any doubt that the particles are moving forward?
No doubt.
What about Mrs. Kennedy? What, if anything, do her movements indicate? Additional computer analysis of the film, measuring motion's direction and velocity, suggests the following. She may have pushed her husband backward while pushing herself forward, away from him, as a reflex reaction when the fatal shot hit. If true, that could help account for some anything do her movements indicate. Additional computer analysis of the film, measuring motion's direction and velocity, suggests the following. She may have pushed her husband backward while pushing herself forward, away from him, as a reflex reaction when the fatal shot hit. If true, that could help account for some of the backward movement of his head and body. But the key conclusion of this complicated computerized study of the films is analysis of the president's head movements and the direction of particles blown from his head both indicate the bullets that hit him came from behind.
Okay, Gandalf, what do you want to add? Okay, Gandalf's not ready, so continue on here. The Audible book by Michael Shermer.
And a 2016 Chapman University survey found that half of all Americans believe that the government is covering up what they know about the JFK assassination. So ubiquitous are JFK assassination conspiracy theories that there's even a joke featuring a conspiracy theorist who dies and goes to heaven, where God offers to reward him for living a good life by answering any question he'd like to ask. Conspiracy theorist, who actually killed Kennedy? God. Lee Harvey Oswald, acting alone, using his own Carcano M91 rifle. Conspiracy theorist, this goes higher than I thought. Speaking to a conference of top-notch lawyers shortly after Oliver Stone's film JFK was released in 1991, Vincent Bugliosi asked how many of them did not believe the findings of the Warren Commission that JFK was killed by a lone assassin. Nearly everyone in the room raised their hands. When asked how many had seen Oliver Stone's film, roughly the same number of hands shot up. Bugliosi then asked how many of them had read the Warren Report. Quote, it was embarrassing. Only a few people raised their hands. The overwhelming majority in the audience had formed an opinion.
So I strongly recommend the Philip Shannon book. So let me play a little bit from this talk here.
Which was published in 2008. Clearly a superb researcher and a superb listener, he heeded the call. In May of 2014, the Society of American Historians honored Philip Shennan with the 57th annual Francis Parkman Prize, awarded annually to a nonfiction book that is distinguished by its literary merit and which makes an important contribution to the history of the United States. It is a very great pleasure to welcome him to Sarah Lawrence College and to the stage.
Thank you very, very much. And I want to thank President Lawrence and the college for having me here today. And special thanks to Vicki Ford, Pauline Metcalf, E.G. Wilmers, and most of all, Cynthia Thomas, for the invitation to be here today. That really is a great honor. And if you didn't know, Cynthia Thomas is the biggest public affairs officer for this campus that you've ever encountered. And we'll be returning to Cynthia's story shortly. But 50 years ago this month, some history was being made in Washington. And it's history that still affects all of us in many different ways. On the morning of September 24th, 1964, the Chief Justice of the United States, Earl Warren, entered the White House and was escorted into the Oval Office. And waiting there was a man he really barely knew, Lyndon Baines Johnson, the president. Warren was a big, white-haired bear of a man. He was a Northern Californian who loved the outdoors, and he usually radiated good health. But on this day, that you see pictured here, he looked really beaten down, just exhausted. Warren had brought with him a big, blue wooden box, and inside that box was a document, an 888-page report that was literally fresh from the printers and would be forever known as the Warren Report. According to Warren, the report that he presented to President Johnson that day answered all the major questions raised by the terrible, earth-shattering event that had taken place 10 months earlier when President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. Warren had run the Blue Ribbon Commission that investigated the assassination. It had a more formal name, but it was known from the start to the public as the Warren Commission. Warren had accepted the job even though it was an assignment he absolutely had not wanted. The other six members of the commission were all prominent figures in Washington, including four members of Congress, two Republicans, two Democrats, as well as a former CIA director by the name of Alan Dulles, the gentleman in the bow tie on the right there, and John J. McCloy, a former president of the World Bank, the gentleman on the far left. In their report, the commission said it had come to a conclusion, a unanimous conclusion, that President Kennedy had been killed by one man, a pathetic 24-year-old misfit by the name of Lee Harvey Oswald. And the commission found, essentially, that Oswald had acted alone. The commission said it found no evidence to suggest any sort of conspiracy, foreign or domestic. And so began that morning, almost exactly 50 years ago today, one of the greatest debates in the modern history of the United States. And the debate centers on the question, did the Warren Commission get it right? Did Lee Harvey Oswald really act alone, or was President Kennedy killed in some sort of conspiracy? Chief Justice Warren said he really thought and he hoped that the report had ended all that debate. But I think there's a pretty easy way for me to demonstrate just how wrong Earl Warren was. And I hope you'll indulge me a minute, but I found this an interesting way to begin some of my talks about this subject. With your permission, let's take a vote. I have this very impressive group of faculty and students and friends of a great American college, smart people, educated people, people with real common sense. So may I ask by a show of hands, how many people in this audience believe there was a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy? Okay. How many people believe that the Warren Commission got it right and that Lee Harvey Oswald probably acted alone? Okay, so I have in front of me mostly an audience of conspiracy theorists. And you're in very good company. An opinion poll taken last year on the 50th anniversary of the assassination found that 59% of the American people believed there was a conspiracy. And some of that suspicion we deal with today is the result of Oliver Stone's famous 1991 movie, JFK. And some people seem to believe that the conspiracy movement really began with that film. And I'll tell you that is not the case. The conspiracy theories were swirling almost from the day of the president's death. And I put it to you, that is a very disturbing thing, that a majority of the American people don't trust their government to tell them the truth about even this great turning point in the nation's history. They don't trust the government to tell them the truth about why their president had been murdered. And the question for me becomes, how do we plan the nation's future when we can't agree on the essentials of its past? The roster of prominent conspiracy theories has always included people who you would think have some real credibility and who may have had access to information that was never shared by the Warren Commission. Who else was a conspiracy theorist? Well, let's start at the top. Lyndon Johnson, the man who established the Warren Commission, ultimately didn't believe the Warren Commission. In the final years of his life, he was convinced that there had been a conspiracy and that Fidel Castro had killed President Kennedy. Another conspiracy theorist, Robert Kennedy, the president's brother and attorney general. In public, Robert Kennedy said again and again that he believed the Warren Commission. He believed that Lee Harvey Oswald had acted alone, when in fact that appears really never to have been the truth. He was telling his friends and family behind the scenes that he thought the Warren Commission was a very flawed investigation and that his brother was probably killed by Castro or by the mafia or even by some rogue element of the CIA. Another conspiracy theorist came from within the commission itself, Senator Richard Russell, one of the seven members of the commission. And many of you in the audience are probably not familiar with his name, but in the 1950s and 1960s, there was no more powerful member of the United States Senate. He was one of President Johnson's closest friends. Certainly, he was Johnson's mentor in Johnson's years in Congress. Russell signed the Warren Commission report, even though he would say later he didn't agree with it. He thought there might well have been a conspiracy. And there are conspiracy theorists among people still in power in Washington today. Last year, on the 50th anniversary of the assassination, Secretary of State John Kerry, President Obama's Secretary of State, that he had never been convinced that Oswald had done this alone. So how did we get into this mess with so many powerful, seemingly credible people, as well as the vast majority of the American public, convinced that the truth about the Kennedy assassination is still not known and that the government is hiding something? Well, I'm going to try to answer that question, but let me backtrack a bit to tell you how Sarah Lawrence figures in all of this. Because a very proud graduate of this college has figured in my efforts to resolve many of the mysteries about the assassination and about the performance of the Warren Commission. She was known on campus by the name Cynthia Robinson. In 1964, after quite a magical whirlwind romance, she married a very fine man by the name of Charles Thomas, pictured right there. And next to Charles, or Charles, is holding their daughter Zelda.
Okay, Gandalf, what do you want to add?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's just interesting because I've been listening to your program since about you started 10 minutes in. And, you know, the way people have approached the Kennedy assassination, whether they are for or against the conspiracy theories, tends to be with the physical evidence. So we have, you know, magic bullet or grassy knoll or, you know, what happened to Kennedy's brain. There's a Zapruder film. I mean, these are like the issues that seem to predominate in the day. But I think it's more important, I think, to take a look at a little more of a metapolitical background. I mean, like the story of politics, you know, to some degree is also a story of political murder. I mean, one of the reasons that the Kennedy assassination shocked so many people in the early 1960s is because this is the halcyon days, the salad days of American post-war mass consumer suburban liberalism. Things were great, weren't they? You had your car, your white picket fence, your house full of kids. I mean, this is prior to, you know, the so-called third worldization of America. It was happy times. And all of a sudden we wake up one day, it's 1 p.m. or thereabout, Walter Cronkite comes on the television, and oh my God, the president's head's been blown off, and who knows what's going to happen. You know, it just had been less than a year since the Cuban Missile Crisis, or actually, you know, slightly more than a year since the Cuban Missile Crisis, which, you know, had sent the world to the brink of a nuclear exchange between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And so people were, you know, probably terrified that we're going to have some other nuclear exchange. Did the Soviets do it? Was something that people had thought. But I think it's more important than the fact that the Kennedy assassination came at a period when, if you study like the documentary evidence of what was going on between the different agencies and power centers within the deep state and the Kennedy White House with all of the conflicts going on, I think it's fair to say that the Kennedy administration is one of the most divided administrations internally since, I think, maybe perhaps Lincoln. And when you consider that fact, I think it's important to think that there certainly were a lot of motives from within certain factions of the deep state to see Kennedy dead. And I think we need to open our minds to that. And the book that opened my mind to it first, it came out, I think, in 1994, or at least the revised edition, I think, came out a couple years later, was by a former Canadian diplomat to Indonesia and a longtime history researcher named Peter Dale Scott. And I think, you know, we need to have, if you have a post-Enlightenment view of politics, and I think, you know, on some level, you've at least on this show played around with it because, you know, you talk about folks like Carl Schmitt, for instance. If you do that, I think you have to look at the JFK assassination with those kinds of fresh eyes.
Okay, looking at Wikipedia, talking about Peter Dale Scott, his book Deep Politics of the Death of JFK was published in 1993. Kirkus calls the book staggeringly well-researched and an intelligent overview not only of the JFK assassination, but also of the rise of politics undermining American democracy. So, yeah, it got some, a lot of glowing reviews, I'm noticing.
Yes, it's probably my favorite book on the JFK assassination. I mean, to get the meta background on. A close second is a book. I actually have a hard copy of this book. I only have a scanned copy of the Peter Dale Scott book on me. It's by John M. Newman. He's an Army historian. It's called JFK in Vietnam, Deception, Intrigue, and the Struggle for Power. He also wrote, I think in 2007, a book on Oswald. I have that as an ebook somewhere on another disc. But that's probably my second favorite JFK book. You're going to get a third JFK book. It'd be, I think it's Jim Douglas, and that's Douglas with two S's, JFK in the Unspeakable. And it's basically why the Kennedy assassination still matters. In my view, those are the top three books to read, because you need the metapolitical and the quote-unquote deep politics perspective first, because you need to see that all these other characters have their own perspectives and biases they're trying to sell.
Okay, and I'd strongly recommend as well the Vincent Bugliosi documentary. Let me go back to Philip Shannon.
Charles was an American diplomat. By all accounts, he was a very fine diplomat. He was a self-made man, orphaned as a child, and raised by a sister in Indiana. He was very smart, spoke several languages. In 1964, the year of their marriage, Charles was transferred to the United States Embassy in Mexico City. At the time, Mexico was an especially important posting, because at the height of the Cold War, Mexico City was considered a hotspot diplomatically. It was sort of Latin America's answer to Berlin or to Istanbul, a place where espionage was performed. There were large Soviet and Cuban embassies, and the Americans and the Cubans and the Soviets were all keeping watch on one another down there. This is Cynthia and Charles at a dinner party in Mexico City with a gentleman on the left who I think Cynthia and I have never been able to identify. And Mexico City's reputation as a Cold War hotspot, as a sort of center of intrigue, was cemented by the fact that just weeks before President Kennedy's assassination in November 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald had visited Mexico City, apparently to get the visas and other paperwork that would allow him to defect to Cuba, much as he had once tried to defect to the Soviet Union. He was an avowed Marxist. He saw in Castro's Cuba, he said, sort of this fantasy of what communist life could be. In its final report in September 1964, 50 years ago this month, the Warren Commission said that Oswald's Mexico trip had nothing to do with the assassination. Mexico is today a big, dangerous, polluted city, but in 1964 it was actually a lovely place to live, and Charles and Cynthia had a very happy life down there. They quickly became known as favorites of the of Mexican artists and intellectuals who were often welcomed into the Thomas home. And in Mexico City, they become friends with this woman, the woman in the center in the white slacks. Her name was Elena Garro de Paz. She was a very prominent Mexican novelist and playwright who was the estranged wife of another famous Mexican writer, Octavio Paz, who would then go on to win the Nobel Prize several years later. In 1965, Elena Garro pulled Charles aside at a party and told him an incredible story. She told Charles that she had encountered Lee Harvey Oswald in the fall of 1963 during his Mexico City trip, and she had seen him at a party, at a dance party, a twist party, and he was in the company of two, she said, beatnik was her word, Americans, young men. Also at the party, she said, was this woman, a woman by the name of Sylvia Duran, a young Mexican woman, a committed socialist who worked in the Cuban consulate in Mexico City. Duran was Elena Garro's cousin by marriage. Elena said that at this twist party, there had been Cuban diplomats and Mexican socialists who were very committed to Castro's revolution in Cuba, and that she had overheard some of these people talk about their hope that somebody would assassinate President Kennedy. And remember, this is the height of the Cold War, a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it's not surprising, perhaps, that people committed to Castro might want to see ill to John Kennedy. We now know, of course, that John Kennedy was trying to kill Fidel Castro at the same time. Elena Garro told Charles that she couldn't understand. She told him that she had shared this story with the American embassy after the assassination, and that she couldn't understand why nobody had followed up on this. Especially, she said, because she knew that Lee Harvey Oswald had an affair with this woman while he was in Mexico City, a brief romance. So Charles Thomas is astounded by the story. He thinks Elena Garro is credible. He knows her. She's a fiction writer, but he doesn't think this is necessarily fiction. And what would it mean if Lee Harvey Oswald, several weeks before the assassination, had an affair with an employee of the Cuban government in Mexico City? What did it mean that...
Okay, remember, men will basically do anything to have sex, and you can't overestimate the influence of a sexual relationship with an attractive young woman. Also, remember, this guy speaking, Philip Shannon, is a long-time New York Times investigative journalist with a distinguished history. This is not some wild-eyed kook.
He was in the presence of Cubans who were talking openly about their hope that somebody would kill President Kennedy. What did it mean he was traveling with two Americans who had never been identified? Was there a conspiracy to kill Kennedy that was hatched in Mexico City? Was it possible that the Warren Commission, which had issued its final report a year before, maybe Warren Commission was wrong? But Charles does what you would expect a good diplomat to do. He reports it up the chain of command at the embassy, including to the CIA station chief in Mexico City. And in those days, the CIA station chief in Mexico City was much more powerful than any ambassador he'd ever worked for. But Charles finds, after reporting this throughout the embassy, that nobody wants to follow up. Nobody wants to go back and investigate what Oswald was doing in Mexico City. Nobody wants to go back and see what was Oswald's relationship with this woman. Yet Charles, to his credit, keeps pressing the issue, asking that somebody please go back and see if there might possibly be any truth in this. And it's an even more complicated, long story. But what happens next is that Charles quickly finds that his career is being derailed, even though he appears to be the model of an American Foreign Service officer. In 1967, he is effectively fired. In the State Department's terminology, Orwellian terminology, the term is he was selected out of the State Department. And after that, he's effectively blackballed by the State Department from beginning a new career. When he tries to get a new job, he can't get the proper references from the State Department, and he has to acknowledge that he was essentially fired by the State Department. And tragically, in 1971, Charles took his own life, leaving behind Cynthia and their two young children, pretty much penniless. In one of his final acts before he was forced out of the State Department, Charles wrote a letter to the Secretary of State. In those days, it was William Rogers. This was the Nixon administration. And he asked, please, that somebody go back to Mexico City and try to figure out if there's any truth in the story told by this writer, Elena Garro, about Lee Harvey Oswald and his activities in Mexico, and whether any of this evidence might point to some larger conspiracy that the Warren Commission had completely missed. And Charles is rebuffed again. The letter is forwarded to the CIA, and there's no follow-up. It's a little difficult to read from back there, but Charles says specifically that he fears that the legacy of the Warren Commission is in danger if nobody goes back and looks at this. After Charles's death, Cynthia mounts a valiant campaign to seek justice for Charles. And she does obtain justice for Charles through what was really a one-woman campaign. She gets Congress to go.
Okay, Gandalf.
Yeah, it's important to stop right here only for a second, because there's a important rejoinder to exactly what Shannon is saying here about the Garro de Paz and the Oswald Duran affair and the Mexico City thing. You know, because people forget there were two government investigations into the Kennedy assassination. The first one, of course, is the Warren Commission. The second one is the one done during the Carter administration. I think it started in 1977, was concluded in 1978. It's called the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And they investigated several political assassinations of the 60s, but the main one, of course, being the JFK assassination. So let me just read a very, very short passage here. By 1978, when the House Select Committee conducted its investigation of the Kennedy assassination, startling information had come to light concerning Oswald's social activities in Mexico City. The committee believes that there is a possibility that a U.S. government agency requested the Mexican government to refrain from aiding the committee with this aspect of its work. This was especially so when the House Select Committee on Assassinations tried to dig into the sources of the persistent story about an Oswald affair with a Sylvia Duran. The relevance of this story is clear. American intelligence contained reports that Duran's sexual services had already been used by the Cuban government, and sexual entrapment was then a commonly employed and highly successful espionage technique. Thus, on the surface, the story implicates the Castro regime in the assassination. However, when you dig into it a little bit more deeply, you know, I'm not going to read all this right here. Basically, the CIA is kind of switching things around, so I'm skipping a couple paragraphs. This is on my ebook copy. It's like 919 of the Oswald book by Newman. The CIA claims it did not learn of all these liaison stories and the affair until after the publication of the Warren Report. The FBI, according to a 1979 CIA memo, had conducted an investigation in Mexico after the assassination, and it concluded that the Garro allegations were without substantiation. This investigation, however, was a little late. On October 5th, 1964, 11 days after the publication of the Warren Commission report, the Lopez report observed that Elena Garro de Paz's story alleging Lee Harvey Oswald's presence at a party in Mexico City attended by Cuban government personnel came first to the attention of the CIA. So when you consider all of those factors I just read, I think it's safe to conclude that the CIA was probably lying.
Okay, and I want to read from Vincent Bugliosi's book, Reclaiming History. The FBI became the chief investigative agency of the Warren Commission. No fair and sensible person could ever accuse the Bureau of conducting a superficial investigation. It was exceedingly thorough. Just two examples, the enigmatic fellow with a checkered history who sat next to Oswald on the bus that transported Oswald to Mexico in September 1963, an extremely peripheral figure, was the subject of an investigation into his identity and background that generated 99 pages in an FBI report. So just read that from Bugliosi. So he apparently was impressed with the FBI's investigation.
Go back and investigate. And it's determined that Charles was fired because of what was described as a clerical error, that his paperwork and his internal files was misplaced, and a glowing inspection report, promotion report, was misfiled into the files of another man whose name was Charles Thomas. And eventually, Cynthia gets Charles reinstated, posthumously, to his position in the Foreign Service, which means that the family has some financial benefit. And Cynthia, at that point, wins appointment herself as a Foreign Service officer, and she would go on to serve as an American diplomat in Thailand and India. Right? Okay, look first word here. In 1975, Cynthia gets a letter from the White House, an apology from President Gerald Ford for the injustice done to her husband. Gerald Ford was a member of the Warren Commission, and we'll return to that in a minute. As part of this case, Cynthia also wins a very important victory for all members of the American Foreign Service, because it's in part on the basis of Charles's case that the state...
So less than an hour after the assassination, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover calls James J. Rowley chief of the Secret Service. So this is at 1:21 p.m. So this is about 40 minutes after the assassination. And when Hoover and Rowley speak, they speculate who was behind the shooting. Rowley mentioned subversive elements in Mexico and Cuba, and Hoover mentioned the Ku Klux Klan. So that's who our leading law enforcement authorities were speculating about less than 40 minutes after the assassination.
The State Department completely overhauls its promotion practices so that the sort of injustice done to Charles can't happen again. And as far as Cynthia is concerned, that's really where the story ended. Justice for Charles and Cynthia off on her new career, important career as an American diplomat overseas. But then in 2011, I come calling. I was at work on a book about the Kennedy assassination, and I had come across declassified documents from the State Department and the CIA that suggested that Charles's departure from the State Department was not the result of a clerical error. Instead, there's reason to believe he was forced out because he was just asking too many questions about the Kennedy assassination and about what had really happened in Mexico City, and what the CIA and the FBI had never bothered to get to the bottom of there. And after a lot of coaxing, Cynthia agreed to talk to me. And together...
So, right after the assassination, the FBI quickly consults what kind of file do they have on Oswald, particularly from the Dallas office. And there's an FBI agent, Hostie, who's in charge of the Lee Harvey Oswald case. So Hostie finds the file, and paperclip to the top is a one-page communique from the Washington, D.C. field office. It's a shocker. Oswald had written to the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C. about a trip he had made to Mexico City at the end of September, during which he had a conversation with a comrade, Costine, at the Soviet embassy there. Hostie had read something about the Mexico trip in October, but he was forbidden to question Lee Harvey Oswald about it for fear of tipping off Oswald and presumably the Soviets to FBI surveillance methods in Mexico. So this was a bombshell. If Lee Harvey Oswald was in contact with the Soviet government, he may have been some type of agent for them, had the FBI been negligent. So Hostie takes the file to his superior, and it gets handed around, and then eventually, I believe Hostie is told to destroy the file to try to clear the FBI's reputation. Okay, Gandalf.
Yeah, well, if you read the John Newman volume in total, and then dig deeper into Peter Dale Scott, it's clear that actually, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald was extremely intelligent. He spoke Russian fluently. I think he was either in the Navy or the Marines. I'm forgetting some of these details. I'm going to have to do a whole presentation. It's been a while since I've really gone to the Kennedy assassination, so I'm kind of I'm flying by the seat of my pants here to come up with all these sources on the fly and get all my recollections. But, you know, the Oliver Stone movie gets a lot more right than people think. I mean, for instance, you know, before we go back to the Mexico City thing, there's a more important story going back, I think, to July and August, is that Lee Harvey Oswald was hanging out for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, which was run by Guy Bannister, who is a mobster and an FBI informant tied to both, you know, of course, the FBI and Carlos Marcello, the big fruit merchant and mobster out of New Orleans. And, you know, Marcello had also been involved in gambling in Cuba prior to Castro's rise to power. So in the end, it's quite possible that Fair Play for Cuba Committee was just basically a mob front to flush out communists who could be turned to potentially turn on Castro. Because by that time, Castro had started to purge a lot of the true believers, is what happens in every single communist movement. And they were trying to see if they could flush someone out of the woodwork to maybe go back down to Cuba to, you know, exact revenge. I think that's what that was all about. And Oswald was kind of acting as a spy or a mole and just that sort of operation. I'm not, you know, the whole idea that is trumpeted around, and I think either Posner or Bugliosi does it in one of their books, that, you know, Oswald was, you know, some communist, and this is basically the narrative being advanced by the Warren Commission, if I recall. I mean, that's just to my recollection, when you really look into all of Oswald's associations, rather, that's just nonsense. He was some double or triple agent. And if you look at Oswald that way, and you start looking at all of his connections that way and seeing how shadowy the foreign intelligence world really is and how many factions there were here at the height of the Cold War, I think that's a much better narrative frame by which to understand Oswald and where he fits.
Well, he was a communist. He was a self-declared communist. He moved to the Soviet Union. On what basis do you say he's not a communist?
Well, he was always working for the FBI. I mean, just because he says he's a communist doesn't mean that he believes he's a communist. I mean, I'm going to have to go through, and when we do another episode on this, okay. I'm going to do a lot more on Oswald, but I've never believed he was a communist.
Okay. Let me go back to the Bugliosi book. So this FBI agent, James Hostey, is his primary line of inquiry when he gets to question Lee Harvey Oswald is about his Soviet contacts in Mexico City. And so he asks, Mr. Oswald, have you been in contact with the Soviet embassy? The question instantly unnerves Oswald. And he says, yes, I contacted the Soviet embassy in Mexico City regarding my wife. And the reason was because you've accosted her twice already. So Oswald grows steadily out of control after he's asked that question. Mr. Oswald, have you been in contact with the Soviet embassy? Mr. Oswald, have you ever been to Mexico City? Not Tijuana, Mexico City. Oswald jumps up like a live wire and slams his manacled fist down on the desktop. No, I've never been there. What makes you think I've been to Mexico City? I deny it. Oswald is shaking and starting to sweat. James Hostey, the FBI agent, has hit a raw nerve, and the other agent, Fritz, works to soothe Oswald down. But for some reason, Oswald gets incredibly triggered, asking if he's ever been to Mexico City, and he lies and denies it when he very clearly had been to Mexico City. Let me go back to Philip Shannon here speaking.
Together, I think we've been able to achieve a lot more justice for Charles. My book opens and closes with the story of Charles and Cynthia Thomas. And it's a story that hasn't been told before, and it's one that makes very clear just how much the Warren Commission missed and how much information was hidden from the Warren Commission that really rewrites the history of the Kennedy assassination. And it explains why we are likely to be plagued forever with conspiracy theories. So please let's return to 1963 and 1964 when the Warren Commission conducts what is supposed to be the definitive investigation of the assassination of the president. President Johnson decided on November 29, 1963, exactly 7 days after the assassination, that there had to be a blue ribbon federal commission to investigate. And he had only one candidate in mind to run it, and that was Chief Justice Warren. Johnson said he had no second choice. The Chief Justice was a very controversial figure in this country in 1963. Under his leadership, the Supreme Court had produced these far-reaching decisions on civil rights and civil liberties, beginning with the Brown versus Board of
Education. So back to the Bugley Osee book. James Hostie's Dallas office of the FBI received a communique that Lee Harvey Oswald, while in Mexico City in early October 1963, so this is about 7 weeks before the assassination, they received the communique that Oswald had visited the Soviet embassy in Mexico City, spoken to one Valery Kostikov, a vice consul at the embassy, and now we also know that he had a sexual relationship with a woman from the Soviet embassy there in Mexico City. Yeah, I'll go back here to Philip Shannon.
Education decision in 1954 that desegregated the nation's schools. So Warren was very unpopular in much of the country, especially in the South. But whatever people thought of Warren, even his critics had to admit that he had a reputation for personal integrity and for independence. And it was important to President Johnson that the investigation be run by a Republican. And Earl Warren was that. He was a lifelong Republican. So Johnson wants Warren. On November 29th, two senior Justice Department officials are dispatched to Chief Justice Warren's chambers at the Supreme Court. And they invite him, on the president's behalf, to run the commission that will investigate the assassination. And Warren turns them down flat. He said he couldn't take the job, and he had very good reasons why. He was the Chief Justice of the United States, and he had a full-time job running one of the three branches of the federal government. There'd been a long history of controversy when Supreme Court justices got involved in outside investigations. Warren had insisted to his colleagues at the Supreme Court for years that they not get involved in outside assignments. And Warren had a second important reason not to want to run this investigation, and it was much more personal. Earl Warren really loved John Kennedy and the Kennedy family. Warren described the murder of the president as being like losing one of his own sons. And as he said it later, it was a sickening thing to contemplate spending every day, every hour, for months, having to think about the murder of his friend. So Warren showed his visitors from the Justice Department the door, thinking that is where the discussion ended. But the Chief Justice clearly didn't know what he was up against in dealing with Lyndon Johnson. Johnson was not going to take no for an answer. He never took no for an answer. When Johnson was majority leader in the Senate and needed a vote or a favor from another legislator, another senator, he perfected something that would become known as the Johnson treatment. He would call in a colleague, he'd close the door, and he'd put his face literally inches away from his target. And then with a mix of pleading and flattery and threats, he would get what he wanted. And luckily, some of that has been preserved.
Okay, back to the Bugley Osee book. So we have the Warren Commission's general counsel, J. Lee Rankin, told the commission that Oswald, there was a rumor that he was an undercover FBI agent or a paid informant. And the FBI denied that. Rankin found it unusual that the FBI was insisting that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin, yet the FBI had not yet run down all the leads in Mexico or in Russia. Chief Justice Warren reflected on this and said, well, if the allegation was true and it ever came out, it could be established that Lee Harvey Oswald was a paid FBI informant, then people would think there was some conspiracy to accomplish this assassination, and nothing the Warren Commission could do could change this impression.
On film. That is Senator Richard Russell, Johnson's close friend, who was forced to serve on the Warren Commission, even though it was just anathema to Russell, who was a fierce segregationist, that he was going to serve on the same body with Earl Warren. This poor man is Senator Green.
Okay, Gandalf.
Yeah, I mean, the Hostie, who was, I think you mentioned him earlier, who was Oswald's handler. I mean, there was an FBI investigation and all sorts of arms and gun running heading out of New Orleans that eventually metastasized into Operation Mongoose. And Oswald has all sorts of ties to all the agents in that network. So, I mean, that would make a lot of sense. And I think Shannon is just, like, completely unaware of that, as far as I can tell from the clips you've played here.
Okay.
Green of Rhode Island. There's actually more to this chain. Johnson's constantly pushing his face into Green. And then Johnson was not above using this treatment on the President of the United States. So within an hour or so of turning down the job running the commission, Warren, Chief Justice Warren, got his own taste of the Johnson treatment. The phone rang in his chambers in the Supreme Court. This is just after his visitors from the Justice Department have left. The phone rings in his chambers at the Supreme Court, and it's the White House insisting that Warren get in a car and come that minute to the White House for an urgent meeting with the president. Warren wasn't told the reason for the meeting. And so Warren sped across town to the White House and was whisked into the Oval Office. And there he got his full dose of the Johnson treatment. The two men sat down. At first, Johnson asked politely for Warren to please change his mind and to agree to run the investigation.
And Warren again refused, saying it just wasn't appropriate for a member of the Supreme Court to run an outside investigation like this. And so Johnson then turns up the pressure to the max, the ultimate Johnson treatment. He tells Warren that there's a possibility that the investigation of the assassination, if it's mishandled, and it's found that the Soviet Union or Cuba have something to do with the murder, the result could well be nuclear war. And Johnson told Warren that he had just talked to the Defense Department and determined that if there was a war in the first strike, 40 million Americans would die. And if that happened, Johnson said, it would be Earl Warren's fault. And I wish I could do a Texas accent, but he said something like, Mr. Chief Justice, I just don't think you want to be responsible for 40 million dead people. And this went on for several minutes until Warren, who was really shaken by what Johnson was telling him, accepted the job, with tears running down his face. And there's a tape recording of a phone call made by Johnson later that night in the White House, in which Johnson, with a certain cruel pride, boasts about how he made Warren cry. And that helps explain, in part, what put the Warren Commission on the path to the damaged reputation it has today, because the man who ran it absolutely did not want to be there. He felt it was inappropriate for him to be there. He hated every minute of it. He only thought of how quickly he could call it to an end. Before any evidence had been gathered, he decreed that the investigation would be over within 6 months, by June 1964. Certainly, he said it must be ended before the presidential election campaign got underway that fall. And as a result, the investigation took shortcuts that left gaps in the investigation, and into those gaps, people have been pouring their conspiracy theories for all these years. You know, I was raised in Northern California, and I was raised to revere Earl Warren, a fellow Northern Californian. But I do hold him responsible for so much of what I think we now know went wrong within the commission. Anyway, I'm going to fast forward a bit, nearly 50 years to the year 2008. And again, I hope you'll indulge me a minute, but let me tell you how I got wrapped up in the story. President Lawrence gave you some of that explanation. In 2008, I published my first book, which was a history of the investigation of the 9/11 attacks, the other great national tragedy in my lifetime that was investigated by a big commission. In those days, I was a reporter in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, and I had covered the 9/11 commission pretty much from start to finish. You'll remember that commission was pretty widely praised for its final report, which found that Al-Qaeda was responsible for the 9/11 attacks. It was considered very well written. It was tough on some government agencies, although it singled no one out, no individual human being to blame. It infuriated a lot of the 9/11 families who felt there were certain people who should be singled out for having botched the intelligence in the summer of 2011 that might have prevented the attacks, 2001. These are the members, led by the two gentlemen in the bottom here in the middle, Governor Tom Kaine of New Jersey, Congressman Lee Hamilton of Indiana. Democrat Kaine was a Republican, but both were thoroughly bipartisan in the way they treated this. So covering the commission turned out to be a great assignment, but after the 9/11 report was issued, I figured I was done with that story, time for something else to do. But then pretty quickly, I was alarmed to start hearing from staff members of the 9/11 commission, the young researchers and scholars who'd really done most of the day-to-day work of the 9/11 commission. You know, there's this polite fiction in Washington that the blue ribbon commissioners on blue ribbon commissions write their own reports and do their own research. That's almost never the case. It's done by groups of scholars and other researchers, many of whom are usually quite young. In the case of the 9/11 commission, I hadn't been allowed to get anywhere near the staffers. They had been under strict orders not to talk to journalists with the threat of being fired if they did. But after the commission closed down, those people were able to talk to me, and they told me that actually I'd missed a lot of the story, certainly a lot of the drama that had gone on behind the scenes. Much of what they told me was about politics, how politics had influenced the work of the 9/11 commission and the presentation of its final report. So what I discovered became a book in 2008, and a lot of it focused on this question of how politics might have warped the 9/11 commission's work, especially its failure to hold any individual accountable for the bungling that led to the terrorist attacks on September 11th. In that book in particular, my research for that book pointed out one thing in particular to me, which was that the staff on the 9/11 commission concluded that 9/11 just didn't have to happen. There was plenty of intelligence in the weeks leading to the attacks that would have suggested there was going to be a big terrorist attack on American soil, but because of incompetence and laziness by government officials, that evidence was never acted on. But again, that conclusion that 9/11 just didn't have to happen if people had done their jobs properly, that's not in the 9/11 commission report, because to reach that conclusion would have been a political football. People with the Bush administration pointing fingers at Congress pointing fingers back at the White House. So after that book got published in 2008 and upset some people at the White House and elsewhere, I was pleased to get some nice reviews. And because of the success of that book, I was able to buy my freedom from the newspaper industry, which was a good thing in 2008. I'm now a full-time author. And a few months after publication, the phone rang at my desk at the Times Washington Bureau, and the caller was somebody I didn't know. And as President Lawrence was telling you, this is a lawyer who had begun his career almost 50 years earlier on the Warren Commission, and he recommended that I do a similar sort of book about the Warren Commission, an insider's history. And he agreed to help me meet all the young staff lawyers who'd really done the work of the Warren Commission. He agreed to help me so long as I never named him, because he knew I would stumble onto embarrassing information, which sure enough I did. By then, in 2008, Chief Justice Warren and the other six members of the commission had long since passed on. But most of the staff lawyers, the people who'd done the actual digging of the Warren Commission, were still around. And they would talk to me with his assistance. At first, I was really hesitant to take this on, because the Kennedy assassination story really is a morass. And something like 2,000 books have already been written on the subject.
I wish you could see my home library. I think I should be wearing a tinfoil hat. But then I thought it through, and I thought, well, this is a book that nobody's really done before. What really happened inside the Warren Commission? What did these young lawyers really learn? Was there some sort of cover-up they participated in and would acknowledge to me? You know, they'd been involved in what should have been the greatest detective story of the 20th century. What would they have to tell me? And so I plunged in, traveling around the country, talking to more than 20 of the commission's former staffers, and many of them had incredible stories to tell, stories they hadn't told ever before. And shades of 9/11, what I quickly learned about the Warren Commission from the people who'd done the detective work of the commission was just how flawed that investigation was. I was surprised at how willing some of them were to acknowledge that to me. These men, and in those days they were all men, in 1964, they had great pride in their individual contributions to the Warren Commission, but they were alarmed by just how much evidence they had missed. And there were important witnesses who were never interviewed by the Warren Commission. There was evidence that went unseen. It turns out that the staff of the Warren Commission was never permitted to see President Kennedy's autopsy photos or x-rays from Bethesda Naval Hospital. And the staff was outraged because they considered that the essential medical evidence they needed to determine how the president had died. Why didn't staff see the x-rays and autopsy photos? Because Chief Justice Warren bowed to the request of the Kennedy family, his dear friends, and agreed to keep the photos and the x-rays hidden away. And it's only one of a number of examples of instances in which the Chief Justice made decisions that were designed to shield the privacy of the Kennedy family, even if that meant that not all the facts about the assassination were gathered. Warren said later in life that he did see the autopsy photos. They were brought in an envelope to his chambers at the Supreme Court. And he opened the envelope, and the photos spill onto his desk, and he sees just how horrifying they are. He said he couldn't sleep properly for days after seeing them. And then he decided in his own mind that nobody else would see them. None of the other commissioners, nobody on the staff. And the result of that decision today is that a lot of the medical evidence about the Kennedy assassination is hopelessly muddled. And that is the reason we now deal with hundreds of conspiracy theories that you can go find on the Internet this evening about the autopsy, about the condition of the president's body, and about the validity of the so-called single bullet theory, which is this perhaps the most controversial conclusion of the Warren Commission staff about the fact they believe that one bullet had passed through President Kennedy's body and then passed into a second body, that of Texas Governor John Connally, who was sitting in front of him.
Okay, I want to go back to the Vincent Bugliosi book, which is excellent, Reclaiming History. Lee Oswald's brief stay in Mexico City has become a happy hunting ground for dedicated seekers of a conspiracy to assassinate John F. Kennedy. Less than 2 months before the murder, Oswald made contact with the embassies of two hostile communist countries, the Soviet Union and Cuba. And as would be the case with any ordinary citizen visiting Mexico, there can be no certainty about how he spent all of his time in Mexico City or whom he might have met there. Has been claimed that he met socially with Cubans in Mexico City, that he made open threats against President Kennedy in the presence of Cuban embassy officials, most improbably of all that someone else posed as Oswald for the visits to the embassies. Okay, let me get back to Philip Shannon.
In shades of 9/11, I discovered something else that really astonished me about the Kennedy assassination, and that is very prominent in my book, in which I think in many ways writes the history of the assassination. And the Warren Commission didn't say it, but it's very clear that the Kennedy assassination just did not have to happen. It could have been prevented, probably easily prevented. Government agencies, in particular the FBI and the CIA, had just done their jobs if somebody had bothered to connect the dots. That is not the way the FBI and the CIA wanted to portray it in 1964, though. They wanted to pretend that Kennedy's death really wasn't anything they could stop, that Lee Harvey Oswald was the ultimate lone wolf, delusional, violent young man who had no outside support of any kind. And in many ways, the FBI and the CIA bamboozled the Warren Commission into believing that. And that just may not be true at all. There was evidence suppressed by both the FBI and the CIA in 1964 that would have shown just how much those two agencies knew about the danger that Lee Harvey Oswald posed, and specifically posed to John Kennedy. It turned out that there was evidence that Oswald had actually told other people he was going to kill President Kennedy. And a lot of that evidence involves a mysterious trip that Lee Harvey Oswald made to Mexico City. I admit I knew nothing at all about this Mexico trip and Oswald's visit there until I got to the research for the book. But Oswald was there. He was dealing, we now know, with Cuban spies and Soviet spies and Mexican civilians who are very sympathetic to Castro's revolution. And at some point, it appears, in September 1963, he marches into a communist embassy and announces his plan to kill President Kennedy, which means that people heard him say that. And let me show you what I think is the single most eye-popping document that I came across in the course of all my years of research on this subject. And it's not this one. It's this. It's a memo from J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director, to the Warren Commission, labeled top secret, June 1964, right in the middle of the commission's investigation. Sorry, you're going to have trouble reading it, but I can read out a portion for you. In which Hoover revealed to the Warren Commission, and I think very reluctantly, that the FBI had learned that Oswald had announced while he was in Mexico City that he was going to kill President Kennedy. Supposedly, he storms into the communist embassy. Every indication is it's the Cuban embassy, makes the announcement.
And let me go back to Bugliosi's enormous book. So book two, section two, really, of his book, Reclaiming History, Bugliosi writes, over the past 44 years, so this book came out something like 2007, close to 1,000 books have been published on the Kennedy assassination. What follows is the first anti-conspiracy book. Lest there be any confusion, several books have taken an anti-conspiracy position, but the mere taking of the position with very little supporting text does not make the book an anti-conspiracy book. In his book, Conspiracy of One, Jim Moore devotes one sentence, not one page, to rebut the main argument of the conspiracy theorists that the CIA was behind Kennedy's murder, nothing to the FBI or Castro or anti-Cuban exiles. Two sentences to organized crime, nothing to the military-industrial complex or the KGB. In all deference to Mr. Moore, wrote a fine book if you title it Conspiracy of One, meaning you believe that Oswald acted alone and there was no conspiracy, you have to set forth the various conspiracy theories, such as it's the CIA, organized crime, KGB, etc., and then attempt to refute them. So Gerald Posner in Case Closed is much better than Moore, but again, his book cannot be considered an anti-conspiracy book. Posner devotes only approximately 50 pages of a 607-page book to refuting the various conspiracy theories. But at least half of those pages are spent on rebutting New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison's charges. Posner does not address and try to disprove the theories of right-wing military industrial complex or anti-Castro Cuban exile involvement in the assassination, though he makes several passing references to the CIA, could not find more than two or three full pages in his entire book about alleged CIA complicity in the assassination. So, the curious and remarkable fact remains that with the majority of Americans believing there was a conspiracy in the murder of President Kennedy, and with over 1,000 books being written on the president's murder, no previous author has seen fit to tackle the issue head on and knock down all the various alleged conspiracies. So, that's from Vincent Bugliosi. Back now to Philip Shannon, veteran New York Times reporter turned author.
And you'd think that if the Warren Commission knew about this letter, it would have raised a million questions about what happened in Mexico City. Who else heard Oswald say this? What did they tell him to do in response to this? Did anybody suggest to him, yes, that's a good idea, go back to Texas, and if you have your chance, kill the president? Well, remarkably enough, this document then vanishes. I've talked to members of the commission staff, the ones who should have seen this, and they tell me they're astonished because they're convinced they didn't see it in 1964. And if they had seen it, they would have gone back to Mexico City in a heartbeat to try to figure out what this meant.
Okay, so the chat asks, what's so special about Mexico City? We do know that Lee Harvey Oswald, about 2 months before he assassinated John F. Kennedy, went to Mexico City and he entered the Cuban embassy and spent time there. He entered the Soviet embassy and spent time there. He slept with a woman there who I think was connected to the Cuban embassy. So he had close, intimate ties, spent time with two countries, two powers that had significant incentives for wanting to take out John F. Kennedy. That's why Lee Harvey Oswald's trip to Mexico City and his visits to the Cuban and Soviet embassies there, that's why it's so significant and so curious. And that was the immediate American reaction after the Kennedy assassination. I mean, I mentioned within 40 minutes of the assassination, the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, and the head of the Secret Service started talking about who would want to do this. And one of the first things that came up was Cuba. And Americans were thinking, was it the Cubans? Was it the Soviets who were ultimately behind this assassination? And the president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, used that to get Warren to become, to lead the assassination investigation by telling him that this could lead to a nuclear war. So Lee Harvey Oswald's visit to Mexico City about 2 months before the assassination and his visits to the Cuban and Soviet embassies, repeated visits, are highly significant.
Why did it disappear? I think their best guess in mind is that it had a lot to do with the fear of people at the CIA and the FBI, that the commission might stumble onto evidence, especially in Mexico, of how much the government had really known about Oswald before the assassination and the damage he might pose to the president. Remember, This is just the thing that Charles Thomas, Cynthia's husband, was pleading for somebody to go back and investigate. So here I am all these years later with a conclusion in my own mind that the American public was not well served by either of the big investigations of national tragedies of our time, the Warren Commission investigation and the 9/11 Commission investigation. Neither revealed information the public was entitled to. Most importantly, the fact that these tragedies just did not have to happen.
More here from Bugliosi. He says, conspiracies happen all the time and in very serious crimes. John Wilkes Booth was the leader of the conspiracy to kill Abraham Lincoln. The CIA conspired with organized crime to try to kill Cuban dictator Fidel Castro. In the famous Dreyfus affair at the end of the 19th century in France, several high-ranking French military officers conspired to frame Alfred Dreyfus, a Jewish army officer, for high treason for purportedly revealing French military secrets to Germany. So, yeah. Vincent Bugliosi does believe that conspiracies happen all the time and that they can be incredibly consequential.
If government agencies had done their jobs. Neither investigation offered the sort of accountability that I think most people would insist on. The result of that lack of accountability is the fact that a lot of people who watched the intelligence that might have prevented the Kennedy assassination, 9/11, not only kept their jobs, many of them were thereafter promoted in their jobs. And I'll tell you, there's still people I know who are prominent in the federal government who have an awful lot to answer for in 9/11. And it has certainly got me wondering if we don't need to find a different way to think about how we investigate national tragedies, because unhappily, another national tragedy, some sort of massive natural disaster, a terrorist attack, some awful industrial accident, it's coming. It's only a matter of time. And we're going to face this situation again probably sooner rather than later. There were big differences between the way the Warren Commission and the 9/11 Commission, with the ways they were organized. The 9/11 Commission was created in a hurry. It was underway 7 days after the assassination, and the choice of the commissioners was left entirely to the president. And that president, Lyndon Johnson, selected men, some of whom who had a terrible conflict of interest, especially former Director of Central Intelligence Alan Dulles, the man who ran the CIA for much of his existence, but who was fired after the Bay of Pigs fiasco when the United States tried to invade Cuba in 1961.
And this is Bugliosi. It couldn't have been more obvious within hours after the assassination that Oswald had murdered Kennedy, and within no more than a day or so that he had acted alone. This is precisely the conclusion that virtually all local Dallas, state, Texas, and federal FBI and Secret Service law enforcement agencies came to shortly after the assassination. Nothing has ever changed their conclusion. That's Bugliosi's point of view. Gandalf, you want to add something?
Yeah, I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, the Dallas Police Department was known to be extremely corrupt. I mean, Jack Ruby, or Jack Rubenstein, who was tied to David Yaris and Sam Giancana and was trafficking drugs and hookers all the way up to the Chicago mob, you know, was friends with all of those cops, and, you know, definitely shot Oswald for, you know, reasons to cover up something bigger. And, of course, everyone's going to go mum and keep the cover story. I mean, Bugliosi doesn't even consider the alternative hypothesis here. I think that conclusion is completely glib. I mean, I haven't read the Bugliosi book in like 10, 12 years, but I just found that book. It just drove me nuts.
Okay, let me play more here from Phil Shannon.
What we now know is the CIA withheld a tremendous amount of information from the Warren Commission, including the fact that the CIA, under Alan Dulles, had been trying to assassinate Fidel Castro, sometimes with the assistance of the mafia, which you would think, if, and we now know Castro knew about it, which you would think might give him a motive to want to see President Kennedy dead. Among the other members of the commission was Gerald Ford, then an ambitious young member of the House of Representatives from Michigan. And Ford had his own set of terrible conflicts of interest, including one, his very close and very secret relationship with the FBI. We now know from FBI documents that Ford actually called in one of J. Edgar Hoover's top aides about a week after the commission got underway and announced that he was going to volunteer to be the FBI's secret source on the Warren Commission. He would feed the FBI what was really going on within the commission. Johnson also picked men who were very, very busy. They just didn't have time for this investigation. And as a result, most of the members of the Warren Commission barely participated in its work. Apart from Ford, the other members of Congress essentially disappeared. So the investigation, the real detective work, and the analysis was left in the hands of the staff. This is the staff of the Warren Commission. They were a group of very bright, but very young lawyers, most of them.
Okay, I want to read more from Bugliosi. Many conspiracy theorists embellish the motive argument to prove that a particular group killed Kennedy by saying that this group had the motive, means, and opportunity to do so. They present this almost as a prosecutorial legal brief. But in my years as a prosecutor, I never once used the phrase, and personally don't know any seasoned prosecutor who has, although I assume some do. Much more so than motive, means, and opportunity are virtually worthless as evidence of guilt. Okay, let me go back here to Phil Shannon.
Them at the start of their careers, a lot in their 20s and 30s. They were real hotshots, most of them out of either Harvard or Yale Law School. But most of them had no experience in Washington, no experience with law enforcement, no background in foreign policy or intelligence.
Gandalf, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I was going to say that I was going to mention something about, you know, the Warren Commission was just done so haphazardly, so quickly. They did not do a careful job on physical evidence. I mean, yes, I think there were legitimate political pressures to get the assassination, you know, behind the country. But, I mean, there was all sorts of stuff going on between the various government agencies. I think I'd sent you earlier in the private chat a memo written by Hoover, I think, on the 24th or the 25th to a certain George from the CIA who was living in Houston at the time, who had been in Dallas on the day of the assassination. That's referring to George H.W. Bush. George H.W. Bush was in Dallas that day. Richard Nixon was in Dallas that day. Yitzhak Rabin was in Dallas that day. E. Howard Hunt was in Dallas that day. A couple of French mobsters were in Dallas that day. There was definitely some sort of all sorts of people with shadowy intelligence backgrounds from several different countries and several different agencies were all in Dallas that day on November 22nd, 1963. And that was not all just a coincidence.
Okay. Get back to Phil Shannon.
There were no specialists in the Soviet Union or Cuba. There were no ballistic scientists. There were no doctors, even though some of the most important debates on the Warren Commission staff involved the medical evidence. And the young fellow who was assigned to focus on the question of a possible foreign conspiracy in the assassination, you know, in many ways the most important part of the investigation, was a 32-year-old lawyer from Denver. Who is really a hero of my book in many ways, but is the first to admit that when he came to Washington, he knew nothing about any of the subjects he was going to be asked to focus on for the Warren Commission. He had no background in foreign policy, the Cold War, the CIA, the State Department. He had never worked in law enforcement. He'd never been to Washington before. And he did so much of this work himself, and he was forced to work so hard that when the investigation ended, he was close to physical collapse. He describes going home on the last day of work, going to bed, and staying there, literally staying there for 3 days. The staff of the 9/11 Commission was very different and in many ways better, and as a result, its investigation was probably more authoritative and well-organized. There were specialists on intelligence and terrorism. There were historians. There were people who understood the FAA and the Pentagon. There were military officers. And the 9/11 Commission had none of the crazy time constraints faced by the Warren Commission. And the 9/11 Commission really didn't get started for 2 years after the terrorist attack. But politics really limited the 9/11 Commission investigation from the very start. The way the other commissioners were chosen was full of partisanship. They were chosen by the most partisan members of the Congress, the most partisan leaders of the Congress, and as a result, congressional leaders, perhaps not surprisingly, chose a very partisan bunch of commissioners. Politics infected a lot of the early decision-making on the 9/11 Commission. Right at the beginning, the Commission's chairman and vice chairman decided that the politics of this were also poisonous, that, again, there would be no personal accountability, no individual human being would be blamed for any of the failures before 9/11. And I think it's a remarkable thing that to this day, not one person was demoted or fired because of the mistakes they made before 9/11. And as more information has tumbled out about what really happened within the commission, and I think some of it might be linked to the revelations in my book, unfortunately, conspiracy theories are pretty widespread about 9/11 as well to this day. But let me take this full circle. I usually get distressed when I see journalists offer their opinions instead of stating facts, and I'm sure you get distressed too. But having spent so many years of my life thinking now about how the government can and should investigate national tragedies, let me offer a suggestion about what we might want to consider doing. First of all, I say let's get politics out of this once and for all. I suggest there are very talented people in this country, apolitical, outside government, far from Washington, but with a knowledge of how Washington works, who should be leading these investigations. There's no need for some sort of special agency of government to be prepared to investigate national tragedies when they occur. But how about some sort of permanent blue ribbon committee made up of, say, presidents of some of the nation's finest institutions of higher learning, the president of Sarah Lawrence, the University of Texas, of Caltech, of Cornell, whatever, who on a rotating basis are available to be called up to conduct investigations like this. And beyond that, we might establish a pool of the nation's best lawyers and doctors and engineers and scientists and historians and philosophers who could be available and also ready to provide their experience. You know, there was another national tragedy in our lifetimes, or at least in the lifetimes of most of the people in this room, that was adequately investigated and that didn't prompt a rash of conspiracy theories. Let me see if I can find this one again. This is the disaster that struck when the Space Shuttle Challenger broke up 76 seconds into flight in January 1986, taking the seven crew members to their deaths. A month later, President Ronald Reagan created a commission to investigate. It was led by somebody who might have been seen as a partisan, William Rogers, President Nixon's Secretary of State. Everything comes full circle. Who's the guy Charles Thomas writes to try to get somebody to go back to investigate what happened in Mexico City in the Kennedy assassination? Anyway, a month later, after Reagan has organized this commission, led by Secretary of State Rogers, it gets to work. The vice chairman is Neil Armstrong, first man on the moon. And I won't suggest that the space shuttle accident had strong political or foreign policy ramifications, nothing like the Kennedy assassination or 9/11. But there were political ramifications. A lot of people thought NASA should be shut down, that its future was really in doubt. And NASA represents a lot of jobs and political pull in Congress. And there were aerospace contractors who worked on the shuttle who had a lot to lose if the investigation came to the wrong conclusions. But by and large, the Challenger Commission was free of the pressures and the time constraints that damaged the work of the Warren Commission, and it was free of the politics that damaged the legacy of the 9/11 Commission. And the Challenger Commission, it appears, got it right, at least in terms of explaining to the American public clearly and completely how the accident had happened. And you recall the answer was a flaw in something called an O-ring, which is a seal on the rocket boosters that failed when it got cold outside, and it was cold on the day the Challenger flew. The other 10 members included real experts in their fields, including a professor from MIT who was head of the university's aeronautics department. There was a professor of physics from Stanford. There was Sally Ride, the astronaut who just so happened to have a PhD in physics herself. And perhaps most importantly, the commission's membership boasted this man, Richard Feynman, who was a professor of physics at Caltech, winner of the Nobel Prize in physics, and who was sometimes described as the most brilliant mind since Einstein. And you remember it was Feynman who came up with a simple way of explaining to the public how the O-rings had failed. He got one and he dunked it into ice water. And to show just how fragile the O-ring material became when it got cold. By and large, these weren't politicians. They were outside experts in their field, scientists, engineers, mostly apolitical people. And I think most people who review the work of the Challenger Commission are pretty convinced that, indeed, they got it right. We're not overwhelmed today with conspiracy theories about how the Challenger disaster happened. And so let's use that as a model. When the next disaster strikes, let's make sure the investigation that follows is led by the best, most independent minds we can find, backed up by the best technical and historical analysis of the facts that's available. You know, it's often said that the Kennedy assassination was the moment that the country lost its innocence, and I certainly see that when I travel around the country and talk about this. You know, I'll tell you that people of a certain age, for them, the Kennedy assassination was really like no other event in their lives, more jarring even than 9/11. And I really think the failings of the Warren Report 50 years ago this month.
Okay, Gandalf, you want to jump in?
Yeah, the idea that all these experts, you know, these presidents, universities, even physicists like Richard Feynman and all these people that are supposedly that should have been brought in and they would have done a better job than these, you know, fresh out of law school people that have no history of understanding Washington politics, you know, murder investigations, government agencies, the whole thing. I mean, that's ridiculous. There are no such thing as like apolitical, totally independent observers of events. I mean, this idea that this liberal hubris, and it's a liberal hubris, that there's like some, a completely objective viewpoint out there. And if we just find the right experts and technocrats and we're just going to get it right. No. Everyone brings with things personal biases, moral axioms they work off of that cloud their judgment. I mean, there's very few people that really are fanatically devoted just to truth for truth's sake. And pretty much everybody, by the time they establish a career, particularly in a political type of entity like all of academia was even then, that all the people that are heavily invested in such institutions are by definition political actors. They just happen to spout more or less, you know, what's within the Overton window of established elite liberal opinion. And that's considered objective by liberals themselves who have no introspection about, you know, questioning their own, you know, liberal ideology.
Okay, so back to the Bugliosi book. He knows that many conspiracy theorists call the killing of JFK a coup d'etat. And since a coup d'etat is defined as a sudden unconstitutional change of state policy and leadership by a group of persons in authority, a coup would be required to pull off the massive conspiracy contemplated by conspiracy theories. That is, you couldn't even have a coup without the involvement, cooperation, and complicity of groups like the FBI, the CIA, and the military-industrial complex. And Bugliosi adds, what the conspiracy theorists fail to realize is that there is absolutely no history of coup d'etats in America. They're talking about the United States of America, the most powerful, democratic, and economically stable country in the world, with no history of coup d'etat, of a coup. And even if a coup against Kennedy by powers in America were feasible, what Secretary of State Dean Rusk told the Warren Commission in discounting Russian participation in a conspiracy to kill Kennedy, though, is instructive. Although there are grave differences between the communist world and the free world, even from their point of view, there needs to be some shape and form to international relations, that it is not in their interest to have this world structure dissolve into complete anarchy. The great states have to be in a position to deal with each other, and that requires the maintenance of correct relations. So what Secretary of State Dean Rusk was saying is that with respect to stable foreign nations, it is in the best interest of even adversaries to accept the legitimacy of their opposition. And what Rusk observed between these stable foreign nations is equally applicable internally. Even though, as with every president, our elected leader has many factions in the country, these factions would have many more reasons to accept the continued legitimacy invested in the presidency by our constitutional process than to embrace fascistic principles that would only ultimately promote the insecurity and illegitimacy of their own positions. Why would they want to live in an environment where in the future their political opposition would likely do the same thing to them as they did to Kennedy? The notion that major federal agencies of government, or even one such agency, would decide to murder Kennedy because they didn't agree with certain policies of his is sufficiently demented to be excluded at the portals of any respectable mental institution short of an insane asylum. That's Bugliosi's point of view there. Back to Phil Shannon.
Compounded the confusion that many people felt. Certainly it compounded their distrust. People were convinced not only that history could be changed in a millisecond by a nut with a $21 mail-order rifle, but they also became convinced that their government couldn't be trusted to tell them the truth about why something so terrible had happened. In the wake of the Kennedy assassination and the Warren Report, I really think Americans became more cynical about everything. And so let's at least try to turn that around. There may be straightforward ways of making sure the mistakes of the Warren Commission and the 9/11 Commission are not repeated, that we get politics out of the way. You know, after a national tragedy, after the Kennedy assassination, after 9/11, there's a lot of talk about the need for the nation to heal, for the American public to heal and to move on. And the sad truth is, I think that in the case of the Warren Commission and the 9/11 Commission, a lot of Americans never healed as you would want them to. They never had the proper chance to move on, to believe that what had made us vulnerable to disaster was understood, and to make sure it never happens again. And again, having spent too much time over the last 10 years thinking about these sorts of disasters and tragedy, I'm pretty convinced that nothing would be more healing than the conviction among Americans that we are being told the truth, or at least that there has been a totally honest, independent effort to get at the truth. Because once we have that conviction, once we believe we know the truth about these disasters that will always befall us, I think the healing really begins. Thank you very much.
Okay, that's Phil Shannon. I want to go back to the Michael Shermer audiobook, Conspiracies and Conspiracy Theories, What We Should and Shouldn't Believe and Why.
Opinion, rejecting the findings of the Warren Commission without bothering to read the commission's report. And these were professional lawyers passing judgment on a murder case, knowing next to nothing about it. There has been so much published on the JFK assassination that I could fill all 12 lectures of this course with nothing but different conspiracy theories. And once you go down that rabbit hole, a problem becomes apparent. Most of the theories contradict each other, and none have identified a second shooter, much less a conspiring organization. For example, those who think organized crime was behind the assassination are in conflict with those who think it was orchestrated by the FBI. If you think the CIA did it, then it can't have been done by the CIA's Russian opposite, the KGB. Oliver Stone's film, JFK, implicates just about everyone, including the Dallas Police Department, the Secret Service, Vice President Lyndon Johnson, the FBI, the CIA, the KGB, Fidel Castro, anti-Castro Cuban exiles, organized crime, and especially the military-industrial complex. If everything is a conspiracy and everyone a conspiracist, then nothing is explained. My own opinion on the matter has changed over time. When I hadn't read much on the subject, I just assumed that the Warren Commission report that Oswald acted alone was correct. But after I saw Oliver Stone's film, JFK, I came to suspect that there might be more to the story, and possibly even a real conspiracy to assassinate the president. That's the power of film. And who can forget Kevin Costner's character, Jim Garrison, running the Zapruder film over and over for the jury, showing Kennedy's head snap back and to the left, back and to the left. But after I read Gerald Posner's and Vincent Bugliosi's books, I changed my mind and reverted to the lone assassin theory, which was later reconfirmed for me after I edited a special edition of Skeptic magazine on the 50th anniversary of the assassination in 2013, in which we debunked the most common conspiracy theories. So let's start this analysis with Lee Harvey Oswald, whom even most conspiracy theorists agree was involved in the shooting of the president.
And back to Bugliosi. Though many people have not stopped to realize it, the issue of conspiracy in the Kennedy assassination is two-pronged, the first of which can be disposed of in one sentence. Since we know Oswald killed Kennedy, we also know that no group of conspirators killed Kennedy and framed Oswald for the murder they committed. You can only frame an innocent person, not a guilty one, so this type of conspiracy has been taken off the table by the conclusive establishment of Lee Harvey Oswald's guilt. The second issue, and that is the subject of the second half of the Bugliosi book, involves whether Oswald was part of a conspiracy. That is, did he kill Kennedy for other people?
Isn't it? There are entire books, documentaries, and dramatic films about Oswald. By far the best by PBS Frontline, titled, Who Was Lee Harvey Oswald? But here are the core facts that implicate him. Oswald joined the U.S. Marines in the 1950s, where he received riflery training. Contrary to what Oliver Stone has one of his characters say in the film, that Oswald shot Maggie's drawers, meaning he couldn't even hit the target. In fact, Oswald scored the second highest rating possible in riflery, meaning he was a sharpshooter. And if you ever get a...
So I grew up in a world of conspiracy theories. I grew up a Seventh-day Adventist, which is like one giant conspiracy theory. Lifestyle Seventh-day Adventists are the least likely to believe in such theories, most likely to achieve something in this world, and the least likely to stay in the church. While historic Adventists are the most likely to believe in conspiracies, be the most passionately devoted to the church, and the least likely group of Adventists to distinguish themselves in the wider world. There are about 15 million Adventists in the world, but you almost never hear about them because they are about as irrelevant a group as you can find. They get almost no academic and journalistic coverage because their conspiracy theories and church-taught passivity, waiting for the soon coming of Christ to take them to a much better world, do not tend to lead to achievement. My father, who has two PhDs, was constantly importuned by these nutters who wanted his time so that they could elaborate their various views on how this world would end, how the papacy would bring about national Sunday laws, and how the Pope would persecute Sabbath keepers and the like. So I grew up with people immersed in various conspiracy theories about how John F. Kennedy was not assassinated by Lee Harvey Oswald, and the like. Many of these same people had similar conspiracy theories about how there never was a Holocaust. All these conspiracy theorists had something in common. They were all losers. So my father's friends who had PhDs from good universities or who were medical doctors were rarely prone to conspiracy theories. It seems like people who feel in charge of their lives are rarely prone to conspiracy theories. So it seems to be, generally speaking, the least successful people in society who are the most likely to believe in conspiracy theories. Palestinians are particularly prone to believe in conspiracy theories. As soon as you hear someone spouting an outlandish conspiracy theory, you can know with about 99.9% certainty you're dealing with an unhappy loser. Are there any happy losers? So I know about one Jew who believes in a lot of nutty conspiracy theories. This type of thinking, generally speaking, is about as rare in Jewish life as bathroom humor. Jews rarely talk about excretory functions. Gandalf, you have some thoughts?
Well, I guess I'm a loser then, because, I don't buy half the things the government says, and it doesn't, like, drive me up a wall. All this psychologizing, it's just such a dishonest kind of argument. It's just like, oh, that loser over there, he just asks too many questions. He doesn't trust what he's told. It's like, of course I don't trust what I'm told. I mean, look at the condition of this place. Are the authorities and their liberal ideologies and everything that they push, do they care about, like, ordinary people? Of course not. They could give two you-know-whats about us. And do they care about the truth? No, they care about power and money and position and all that other stuff. So psychologizing people who would question institutions, which clearly, you know, are two-faced, that's just a very dishonest line. I mean, I always dislike that. I mean, I always was that kid from when the time I was like three, would ask why. And you'd have to like stick a sock in my mouth to get me to shut up. I'm still that way, and it's 30 years some later.
Okay, I'm looking back through my blog. So I've been blogging for 21 years, and that previous thing that I talked about, conspiracy theories and losers, that was something I blogged about 12 years ago. Now I'm looking at something I blogged back in 2014 when I heard Jeb Bush sympathizing with illegal aliens, saying, yeah, they broke the law, but it was an act of love. And so Jeb's sentiments reminded me of another speech about acts of love. This one was written out by John Hinckley in 1982, just before his sentencing. He said, "From the start, all I wanted was for someone to love me. I desperately wanted to be loved, but I could never give appropriate love in return. I seemed to have a need to hurt those people that I love the most. This is true in relation to my family and to Jodie Foster. I love them so much, but I have this compulsion to destroy them." On March 30th, 1981, when I shot Reagan, I was asking to be loved. I was asking my family to take me back, and I was asking Jodie Foster to hold me in her heart. My assassination attempt was an act of love. I'm sorry love have to be so painful. And you know what? I understand that. I completely understand every word, because even though I've not shot anyone, I get it. Like, I've been there. I remember when I was really into Dennis Prager, my mother remarked, somebody should tell Dennis Prager that you'll hurt him because, you know, you end up hurting everyone you love. You betray everybody. I've watched all these documentaries about losers like Lee Harvey Oswald, Mark David Chapman, John Hinckley, and I understand them. I really feel like I understand what was driving them. They were failing at life. They were failing in their relationships. So, like, how do I have so much time to be talking here on YouTube, right? It's a reflection of various failures in my own life. So these other losers like Lee Harvey Oswald, Mark David Chapman, John Hinckley, they retreated to a fantasy world and desperately sought ways to feel important. And I completely get that. I mean, luckily, you know, I never did anything criminal, but I get this yearning, this frustration, wanting to, like, push away your failure and this yearning to matter. Because when you consistently blow it in real life, you're going to face strong temptations to retreat increasingly to your dreams, to your addictions, to your fantasies, to an exaggerated sense of your own importance, and thereby to discount other people's reality. So when you're closely bonded with other people, you're much less likely to discount their reality. But losers often become true believers, to use the title of the great Eric Hoffer book. So, you know, I've often tried to stave off my own feelings of failure by embracing heroes, by, you know, trying to associate myself with, you know, successful people, just getting a sense of absolute intoxication when I'm around highly successful people. I try to deal with my own sense of failure by chasing women, by converting to Orthodox Judaism, by blogging, by making YouTube videos, by enrolling in a decade's worth of psychotherapy, by embracing 12-step programs, by pursuing the Alexander technique. You know, all these are things that I've done to try to push away this horrible feeling that I'm a loser. So here is a talk by a political scientist, conspiracy theories are for losers.
So how many Americans agree with these ideas? So right now, about 60% buy into JFK theories. It's consistently been a majority for a long time, and that's actually down from where it was in the late 90s, where it was closer to 80%. 25% birther and truther, Obama faked his birth certificate, George W. Bush or someone else blew up the Twin Towers. About a fifth of Americans think that aliens landed at Roswell and the government's covering it up. 20% think Big Pharma is hiding the true dangers of vaccines. 9% of people don't brush their teeth. I brush twice. 6% think the moon landing is faked, and that's an interesting point because when we say the term conspiracy theory, oftentimes moon landing comes right to our mind, but it's actually not a very popular theory, not in America anyway. If you go over to Europe, it's about three or four times as popular as it is here. For Americans, the landing is a point of pride. 5% think the lines in the sky are poison there to kill us, and 4% think that there is a race of reptilians who really control the planet. Interesting, last night, Vaynerchuk said that 4% of Americans believe in vampires. I think it might be the same people. So imagine if you believed in lizard people and vampires. That's like a great world to live in. It's amazing.
I think Vince McMahon did that.
Collective decisions based on bad information, particularly conspiracy theories, we're all stuck with the consequences of that. And beyond collective action, individuals can take action on these theories, and they can cause incredible damage when they do it. So just 2 years ago, a guy got a loaded weapon, went into a pizza shop, and that really upsets me because he said, I used to work in a pizza shop, fired off a round that went only a few feet from somebody's head, then went to a broom closet door, expected to find a secret tunnel that would lead him down to the sex slave children that Hillary Clinton had been molesting and then burning in the pizza ovens. And he was shocked to find brooms in the broom closet. And he went in front of the judge and he said, gosh, I'm really sorry, but I was just there to save the children. And the judge said, one, you're going to jail, and two, that bullet was only a few inches from blowing somebody's head off. So people can take bad action when they believe these theories. Somebody's going to fight fire with fire. So the way I look at these is just like any other opinion, and that is a new piece of information comes in, and we interpret it with a disposition that we already have. As a political scientist, the most important disposition I work with is partisanship. So partisanship, like many of our other existing dispositions, comes from our socialization. When we grow up, we learn about the world, we learn about the government, and we get an identity, and those identities stick with us through our entire lifetime. If I know what party you are when you're in your mid-30s, I know what you are when you're in your late 90s, and the world can burn in the middle, and not much is going to change. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm looking at some of my past blog posts on the Kennedy Association assassination. So this one is from 2011, and is from Reclaiming History, the Assassination of President John F. Kennedy by Vincent Bugliosi. So Dr. John Latimer studied the assassination for years. He concluded that Kennedy's back brace may have been responsible for his death. Dr. Latimer writes that Kennedy had bound himself firmly in a rather wide corset with metal stays and a stiff plastic pad over the sacral area, which was tightly laced to his body. The corset was then bound even more firmly to his torso and hips by a 6-inch wide knitted elastic bandage, which he had wrapped in a figure eight between his legs and around his waist over large thick pads to encase himself tightly. He apparently adopted this type of tight bonding as a consequence of the painful loosening of his joints around the sacroiliac area, probably a result of his long-continued cortisone therapy. When Kennedy and Connolly were struck by the same bullet, the corset prevented Kennedy from crumpling down out of the line of fire, as Governor Connolly did. Because the president remained upright with his head exposed, Lee Harvey Oswald was able to draw a careful bead on the back of his head. The first bullet that hit Kennedy passed through soft tissue, through his neck, did not strike any organ. He would have survived. Okay, back to this poli-sci professor speaking at the Center for Inquiry, where I also spoke about my first book, History of X, 100 Years of Sex in Film. I spoke there in 1999. This video is from May of 2019.
Yeah, some people do switch, but that's the minority of people. Most people are what they are. And these dispositions, I like to think of them as immovable movers. So what I want to do for you now is just build a very simple three-dimensional model that can explain who's going to believe conspiracy theories, which ones they'll believe in, and when and why. So the first dimension of this is I call conspiracy thinking. And it's a predisposition that people have to one degree or another. So some people are way up on the top where they see all events and circumstances as the product of a conspiracy. They're just lurking everywhere. And then there's people at the bottom who are resistant to conspiratorial logic. Most people are somewhere in the middle on this. The second dimension is partisanship. And we have on our right our Republicans, and on our left we have our Democrats. And our third dimension is power, whether you're a loser or not.
Okay, so my own view on the Kennedy assassination is that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole killer, the sole shooter, the only shooter, but I have an open mind as to whether he did it, at least in part, at the behest of other parties. So, Gandalf, do you want to add something?
Yeah, there's not a snowball's chance in hell that Oswald acted alone. I completely disagree. You know, when you have a crime like the murder of a president, let's just think for a second. You know, Luke, you remember who JFK's vice president was and why he was put on there, correct? On
the Lyndon Baines Johnson, he was put on to win an election.
Yeah. Is Lyndon Johnson the kind of man who would be an ally of a Jack Kennedy?
No.
No, not at all. And so if anytime the number one is shot down and number two in any other situation be a mortal enemy, I mean, Lyndon Johnson was put on the ticket just so that Jack Kennedy could carry a few southern states. Not going to be popular in the South. I mean, he's kind of liberal on blacks, you know, and he's Catholic. I mean, that was not going to play with white Southern voters. They had to put Lyndon Johnson on the ticket to carry him through the day and to fix, with his help of his chief of staff, Bobby Baker, the Texas vote. So, but JFK and Lyndon Johnson fought the entire time. And don't think for a second that with JFK out of the way, LBJ could get to where he always wanted to be since, you know, the time he first got to Washington, D.C., I think in like 1939, 1940, which is a chair in the Oval Office. Don't think for a second Lyndon Johnson wasn't someone who was in a prime position to want JFK killed. I mean, there's a trail of bodies that Lyndon Johnson left in Texas politics. I mean, politics is a blood sport. This idea that, you know, some radical communist comes out of nowhere and just shoots the president and there's just, oh, case closed. We've got a bunch of lawyers just walked out of college and had no experience in anything. And they had a bunch of really powerful people with a bunch of skeletons in their closet, you know, in relationship to President Kennedy to all hide. And they're going to like wrap this up real quick. And it's an open and shut case. And everything is just signed, sealed, delivered. That's not the way the world really is, especially not, you know, at the height of the Cold War and the America of that day. So no, I mean, if you were to, just if you didn't know anything about the Kennedy assassination and you just were looking for suspects, whether or not, you know, let's just say Lee Harvey Oswald was the only shooter. Okay, maybe someone put him up to it. There's lots of people that always want a president dead. I mean, hell, how many crazy Hollywood actors have threatened President Trump? And we've laughed about it, you know, all over the place. I mean, this is just the nature of power politics. I mean, if you look at the Kennedy assassination, you see that, oh, Lyndon Johnson's his vice president. Oh, Kennedy ends up dead. The first thought that should come into your mind if you knew anything about just the architecture of power and just the various alliances and oppositions that existed in D.C. is like, okay, Lyndon Johnson was behind it. I mean, that's the sane way of thinking about it. America's not exceptional. I mean, in other countries, I mean, Saddam Hussein was the number two, and he was involved in a coup that threw over number one. I mean, same things happens in all sorts of instances in politics. Number twos who are ambitious and embittered, and the number one is a playboy who everyone likes. I mean, assassinations, okay, coups always happen.
Yeah, let me play more here.
Well, that's our third dimension. And there we have our winners, people who are in power. They are part of the institution. They have power over others, and they feel good about their position. And on the other hand, we have the outsiders, the losers, and the people on the bottom end, power asymmetry. So let me talk about each dimension, and then I'll put the whole model together and explain sort of what happened in the 2016 election. You guys get this joke, right? There you go. All right. So conspiracy thinking. So we do surveys, and we measure how conspiratorial people are in their thought by giving them three statements. So much of our lives are controlled by plots and secret places. Even though we live in a democracy, a few people really control things. The people who really run the country are not known to the voters. So when we do this nationwide, we get something like this, where most Americans are somewhere in the agree area, and we take their responses to these statements, from strongly agree to strongly disagree, and we give each respondent a score, which we call their conspiracy thinking. Now, the difference between someone on the high end and someone on the low end is something like this. We asked another question where we gave them a list of 10 groups, and we said, which of these groups do you think are actively conspiring against us right now? The people on the high end of our conspiracy thinking scale picked on average between 5 and 10 groups. People on the low end picked less than 1. So if you're on the high end of that scale, you don't go out at night because everybody's out to get you. So the popular character, and I want you to close your eyes just for a second, and imagine, who is that typical conspiracy theorist? Who is that person, and what does that person look like? So what color is that person? White. What gender are they? Male. What age? Middle-aged. And then what are their politics? Conservative. Oh, my God, I'm like Banachek up here. This is great. I read your minds. And, oh, my God, oh, no, it's me. That's me right there. That's even worse. So that's the popular character, and we would imagine, oh, my God, it's these guys that we always see on YouTube saying something conspiratorial. But the data tells a very different story, and conspiracy thinking cuts across gender almost perfectly evenly, across race, age, partisanship, and political ideology are almost even. A lot of people won't believe that. But let me give you a really neat example. So the show The View, made by women, largely for female audiences, is chock full of conspiracy theorists. So there we have her, vaccine conspiracy theories. She says that the moon landing was faked. And, of course, jet fuel can't melt steel, but yesterday we learned that it can. So conspiracy thinking is everywhere. So better predictors that we find across many studies are better education, and people who tend to make more money tend to have less levels of conspiracy thinking. Why that is, we're not quite sure yet. We're getting there. But it could be that, you know, if you're hiring somebody in a high-profile job that has a lot of responsibilities, you're not going to hire a hardcore conspiracy theorist to do it, unless you're voting. Now, this is not a perfect predictor, but in general, these are the trends that we tend to find. Other characteristics of people who are high in conspiracy thinking, they're less likely to register to vote by about 30 points, less likely to vote, less likely to put up yard signs, less likely to volunteer for political campaigns. They're more likely to join third parties. Economically, even controlling for their income, they're less likely to invest in the stock market.
Gandalf, you had some thoughts.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, like, you know, he's touting all these things. The most interesting one he mentioned was those who tout conspiracy theories are much less likely, you know, to, like, rise to certain measures of prominence. It's like, well, yeah, powerful organizations don't want people who have pattern recognition capabilities of wanting to analyze how power networks actually work. What powerful organizations want are people that want to go through, as the writer of a certain manifesto said, the power process, and they're willing to do anything to signal their way up to the top. This is why one thing I had noticed when I was starting to question 9/11 around the time of the Iraq War, was that it was I had much more trouble getting the peace activists I was always marching with in college. I had much more trouble getting them to question 9/11 than I ever did, like, more like skeptical right wing folks who are questioning 9/11 and the Iraq War for this very same reason. I mean, in a liberal society, you're never supposed to believe that there's a cabal of people that conspire for private interests on any issue. You're supposed to trust that, yes, liberalism is objectively true, and democratically people, you know, are going to make decisions within the liberal framework. And, you know, the reality of the world is that none of this is true, and he just is simply trying to mock people who disagree with him and pepper over all of it by looking at people that question society as being low status because they question society.
Wait, give me 2 minutes on what you mean when you say you question 9/11.
Yeah, I mean, I started questioning 9/11 right around the time they were selling us the Iraq War so hard at the end of 2002. A lot of things started just not adding up to me. I mean, the first thing was when I started noticing websites and blogs showing pictures of Building Number 7, which wasn't hit by a plane, and all of a sudden it pancakes like it was demolished. Then I remember the PBS special where the owner of that building had talked about pulling the building. And he talked about it in such a way in the clip that he talked like he had ordered it demolished himself. I mean, the whole story just seems so weird. And that they magically knew who all these hijackers were for this plane hours after it happened, and they had the passports of those guys that would just magically survive the rubble. I mean, all these things were it was like a staged movie set. I mean, I've watched and read plenty of detective novels when I was a kid, and it's like, wait, you know, if I want to investigate, you know, the attack and murder of 3,000 Americans that destroyed iconic landmark buildings, I don't think I'd find the answers that quickly.
Okay, I want to get back to this lecture here by the political science professor.
If you think that the markets are rigged and the politics is all rigged, you're not going to take part. In terms of violence, when we ask people if they condone violence against the government, those on the very high end of conspiracy thinking are much more accepting of violence. And this creates a very toxic cocktail, because what studies show is that people who think in conspiratorial terms are likely to want to use conspiring themselves to achieve their own ends. They're more in favor of liberalized gun laws, and they're more in favor of violence. So Timothy McVeigh makes a perfect example. He fought fire with fire. He believed the government was conspiring to take away people's rights, so he conspired right back, killed a whole lot of people in Oklahoma. Our second dimension is partisanship. So our brains are really hardwired into our party. It's not like we sit down and say, well, should I be a Republican or a Democrat today? I mean, these identities are with us. They're very tribal, and they control how we view everything. So this disposition affects how we see the economy, how we see most aspects of the world. So, for example, polling came out yesterday showing that Republicans and Democrats equally see their financial situation doing pretty good, right? Both Republicans and Democrats say, yeah, I'm both doing about equally well. But when we ask Republicans and Democrats, do you think that the economy as a whole is doing good? Republicans say it's doing great. Democrats say it's doing terrible. When we asked the same questions during the Obama administration, when the economy was almost exactly the same, Republicans said it's absolutely terrible and all the numbers are faked. And Democrats said it's just wonderful. Not that much has changed in the time, just the perceptions based on our partisanship. And one way that this works is that people tend to follow their political leaders. If you have trusted leaders, you tend to listen to what they say, and people tend to take cues from them. And those are incredibly powerful. So when we poll the nation, we ask Republicans and Democrats, who do you think is conspiring against us right now? And Democrats believe corporations and conservatives are out to get us, and Republicans think that liberals and communists are out to get us. Mirror images of each other, just pointing fingers back and forth. And this works with things other than partisanship, too. So we know who they are. The Da Vinci Code conspiracy theories. Jesus had children with Mary Magdalene. They escaped to France, and they are being hunted now by the Catholic Church. So who believes this sort of stuff? Well, studies show it's people who are into New Age ideologies, so these sorts of folks. Who doesn't believe these sorts of theories? Well, definitely him. Not into it at all. If you're a football fan, you know about Deflategate a few years ago. Tom Brady was accused of deflating the football so they'd be easier for his receivers to catch, and there was a lot of debate over did he really deflate the footballs. So what a study found was people who were living outside of New England believed that he was a cheater, and they thought he had deflated the balls. If you lived in New England, then you didn't. And just to go back to the Kennedy assassination theories, why do so many people believe in it? And it has to do it has to do with the way the poll question is asked. When you say, do you think there was a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy, you get 60% saying yes. But when you ask a second question, who do you think did it, then you wind up with a lot of disagreement. 5% say it was Castro, 6% say it was the CIA. If you ask Oliver Stone, everyone did it. So that's why you get those high numbers with Kennedy. So our third dimension is power. So we asked people nationwide right before the 2012 election, if your candidate loses, do you think it will be due to fraud? Equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats said yes. But after the election, and we say, do you think the outcome was due to fraud? That number cuts in half. Why? Because only the losers think they were cheated. Winners always think it's hunky-dory. We did the exact same thing in 2016, and there was one subtle difference. And that was election fraud itself became an election issue. And Republican elites, Trump mostly, was saying the election's going to be rigged. And Democrats had to get into it, and they said, no, it's not going to be rigged. So you had more Republicans believing it was going to be rigged prior to the election than Democrats. But after the election, Republican belief in rigging goes way down. And Democrat belief in rigging stayed low for a little while, but once those elite cues disappeared, now we have majorities of Democrats saying that the voting machines were rigged. So my letters to the editor data, so we got all these letters that talk about a conspiracy theory from the New York Times, and we coded them by what group was being accused of conspiring. So we had right, left, capitalist, communists. One thing you'll notice is that Americans love to accuse foreigners and foreign governments of conspiring against us. So when Trump talked a lot about foreigners, whether it was trade deals or immigrants, and that they were all bad for us, he was tapping into something that's very American. We have a long history of accusing foreigners firing against us. Another thing you'll notice is that the accusations were just about the same between right and people accusing the right and people accusing the left, people accusing capitalists and people accusing communists. And if we look at years when a Republican was president, what we find is that most of the conspiracy theories accuse people on the right and capitalists of conspiring. And when a Democrat is president, most of the accusations accuse the left and communists of conspiring. So the last two decades give us a nice example of this. During the George W. Bush administration, we were concerned with 9/11 and Halliburton and Blackwater and War for Oil and all this stuff. And as soon as George W. Bush left office, that stuff became politically inert. Now we were concerned about Barack Obama's birth certificate. Obama blew up the Deepwater Horizon well. Obama killed the kids at Sandy Hook. So we tend to flip back and forth. The only difference is that right now you have conspiracy theories on the left, but you also have them on the right. And I would not have predicted that in a normal year, but this isn't a normal year. And I want to explain why in just a moment. So what we see from this data normally is that the targets and timing of conspiracy theories tend to follow a logic. So conspiracy theories are generally used by groups to manage things that they see as a danger to them. And they're about threat perception. And that this threat perception is really driven by power. And because defeat and exclusion really drive them, conspiracy theories are for losers. But why is that not happening now? Why do we have a party that controls the executive, judicial, legislative branch engaging in so much conspiracy theory? Well, 2016, we had two candidates pushing conspiracy theory. So one was Donald Trump, and I don't think there was a conspiracy theory he didn't like. So he started with the birth certificate, and then he moved to Obama's college transcripts. Lots of things about foreigners, the FBI. He's been dancing with 9/11 truth theories. And, of course, Ted Cruz's dad killed JFK. But if you boil all these down to one statement, even the goofy ones, there's a singular idea there that he was trying to push. And it's that American political elites have sold out the interests of regular Americans to foreign interests. That's what he was arguing. And if you look at the people that supported him in the primary, on our conspiracy thinking scale, Trump supporters were the most conspiratorial. So comparing him to a more establishment candidate like Kasich is a big difference. And that's exactly what we'd expect. Bernie Sanders, he had a singular conspiracy that he pushed all the time, and he used the word rigged quite often. And there was only one speech where he didn't use the word rigged, and that was at the DNC convention. I think they told him he couldn't use it because there were accusations of rigging that popped up that week. So he used the word.
Dando, if you had some thoughts.
This guy papers over the fact that the elites haven't sold out the people. I mean, we've had declining living standards and mushrooming poverty, particularly at least among heritage Americans in the inner city ghettos and in the, you know, the trailer parks and small towns of America my entire life. You know, when you have tons of people in the Rust Belt where I'm from, you know, who desperately voted for Obama over Hillary and then McCain in 2008, and then all switched over to Trump in 2016, and they're going all over the place desperate for anyone to stop the endless wars that their kids are being sent to and stop the door from being totally open to anybody that just walks over getting whatever they want while their living standards continue to decline. Of course they're going to start questioning the government and wondering what the hell is going on. I mean, this guy, I mean, what planet does he live on? Does he not talk to poorer people who are talked down to all the time or assume they're just pieces of crap if they question the elites and their ideologies and narratives? All they get told is they're deplorable, you're racist, you're this, you're that. I mean, if your living standards continue to decline, your leaders continue to talk one thing, and your life continues to go in the opposite direction, you're not going to be too nice, and you're not going to be too trusting. I mean, and for this guy not to recognize that shows you just not living in a humane reality.
Okay. Word oligarchy instead, and then Warren got up after him and said the word rigged 6 times. So his thing was the 1% controls all our politics and all of our economics. And he said things like, they are making it hard for you to survive. They control everything. And they have a greed that knows no end. So we find the same thing when we poll people on Bernie Sanders. So what we found even now is that support for Sanders is highly correlated with conspiracy thinking. When we ask vaccine questions, Bernie Sanders supporters are less likely to believe in the safety of vaccines. And he has always formulated his campaigns, even when he started out in Vermont, going after outsider people who felt they were outside the political system. So looking at 2016, Hillary Clinton positioned herself as an establishment Democrat, and she went after those people right there. And there were 20-some-odd people running for the nomination on the Republican side. Bernie Sanders was going after those folks, and Donald Trump positioned himself there. And both Sanders and Trump got 40% of their respective party's vote. Trump was only able to move on because the establishment vote was divided so many other ways. Now we wind up with a Trump presidency. Now it's easy to climb the greasy pole power, much more difficult to stay there. And because he has put together a coalition of conspiracy theorists, people who would normally be outside the system and not take part, he has to constantly poke and prod them with conspiracy theories to keep them donating and to keep them voting and to keep them supporting him. So that's why we have a president who's actively using conspiracy theories. And because he does that, other members of his party do that, and that means that the media has to do it too, because they tend to cover what our political elites say. And that's why I get 100 articles a day with conspiracy theory in it. And this has led at times to not even knowing what's true anymore, because every conspiracy theory is met with more conspiracy theories. And my favorite example of this comes from the 2016 election. The Trump campaign was pushing a conspiracy theory that Hillary Clinton was really, really sick and hiding it from the American public. And the unfortunate thing about this is that conspiracy theories can sometimes change the way that somebody acts because they know they're going to be accused of things. So they have to start hiding even normal behaviors. After the first debate, which Hillary did very well, in order to sort of change the narrative on that, the Trump campaign said the next day that Hillary Clinton was taken off the debate stage on a stretcher with an oxygen mask. On 9/11, Hillary Clinton was sick, and you would expect people to be sick when they shake 2 million hands. I think she had pneumonia. She had to leave the 9/11 memorial early, and people could see her faint as she was getting into her car. This led to the Trump campaign to say, "See, we told you so. She's really, really ill." She got out of bed and came out the next day and started walking around. She probably shouldn't have because she was sick, but she did to prove that she was well. What did conspiracy theorists say the next day? That's a doppelganger. And they could tell because the pantsuit had a different waistline. Some people even said she was dead, and this was a body double. So she went on to the Jimmy Kimmel show to show how strong she was. So she opened a pickle jar to show that she was very strong. The next day, the conspiracy theory was pickle jar was already opened. So that's the world we live in. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks so much.
Okay, I like that, but let me get back to Michael Shermer, his book, Conspiracies and Conspiracy Theories, What We Should and Shouldn't Believe.
A chance to go to Dealey Plaza and visit the 6th floor of the Book Depository building, which is now a museum. you can look out the sniper's nest window and see just how close a shot it was to the president, marked by two white X's in the highway below. Politically, Oswald was an avowed communist who defected to Russia in 1959, worked in a radio factory in Minsk for 2 years, and married a Russian woman named Marina. After he grew disenchanted with the USSR, he moved back to the United States in 1962 to Dallas, Texas, shortly after telling friends that he wanted to move to Cuba to join Castro's communist revolution. This background helps establish a motive for killing JFK. Kennedy was avowedly anti-communist, and after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, also clearly anti-Cuban and anti-Castro. Temperamentally, Oswald was emotionally unhinged and suffered from delusions of grandeur, telling people he had ambitions to one day do something to make himself famous. He was very likely a psychopath. While in Dallas, Oswald encountered the anti-communist crusader Edwin A. Walker, a retired general who once accused the Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren of plotting to destroy the United States by banning.
So I want to go to Matt Stoller's excellent Twitter thread on the big Washington Post article this week with the headline, "You're a bunch of dopes and babies inside Trump's stunning tirade against generals." The new book, A Very Stable Genius, documents how Trump lashed out at attempts by military leaders and diplomats to teach him about U.S. alliances. So Matt Stoller tweets, read this piece and explain how this condescending presentation telling an elected leader he can't follow through on his agenda is anything but outrageous. And from the piece, Trump demanded an explanation for why the United States hadn't won in Afghanistan yet, now 16 years after the nation began fighting there in the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Stoller, how is this anything but reasonable? Back to the article. That phrase disgusted not only the military leaders at the table, but also those uniform sitting along the back wall. They were all sworn to obey their commander-in-chief's commands. Here he was calling the war they had been fighting a loser war. Wow, so Trump wasn't very polite. Systemic lying by generals and high-level officials is not the issue. The problem is the elected president says true things in mean ways. Mathis patiently lectures Trump on why U.S. troops were deployed in so many regions and why America's safety hinged on a complex web of trade deals, alliances, and bases around the globe. That's insane. The guy was elected to change this. What did they expect? Trump's point about NATO is overstated, but right. Our allies do rip us off, and they do not pay what they pledge to, and how many of them are installing Huawei equipment and acting like we're not allies. By the way, when Bernie or Warren or anyone tries to renegotiate trade deals or end wars, you can expect equally whiny BS from never Trump neoliberal fools. Trump is bad, but this is not about Trump. It's about disciplining those outside the consensus. I love that ex-Goldman Sachs CEO Gary Cohn, former Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson, and Theranos board member Jim Mattis are the heroes in this story. MSNBC Never Trumpers Can't Get Dumper. To be clear, I am a liberal internationalist and a Democrat, and I dislike Trump. But this story is about Trump violating DC norms about social climbing in front of fancy generals and bankers. Excellent Twitter thread there by Matt Stoller. He's frequently got important things to say.
By banning prayer in schools and promoting civil rights for minorities. In April of 1963, just 8 months before he assassinated Kennedy, Oswald attempted to assassinate General Walker by shooting at him from 100 feet outside his home. Walker was struck with bullet fragments to his forearm and survived. And after the Kennedy assassination, it was determined that Oswald used the same firearm for both, an Italian-made 6.5mm caliber Mannlicher Carcano bolt-action rifle, which he purchased by mail order in March of 1963. along with a Smith & Wesson 38 revolver, leaving a paper trail investigators later found. That same Mannlicher Carcano rifle was found with Oswald's fingerprints on it in the sniper's nest on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository building. After Oswald tried to kill General Walker, he told his wife Marina what he had done, and according to her, he also planned to assassinate Richard Nixon when the former vice president and future president visited Dallas, but she locked him in the bathroom to stop him.
Wow. Okay, I want to respond to the chat. Anyone who thinks that vaccines might be dangerous is a crazy kook. I don't know. I think I like the speaker, so I got an open mind, but I do tend to side with the speaker's perspective. Believing in gun rights makes you a kook. He didn't argue that. Thinking Jews have inordinate power makes you a kook. He didn't argue that. If you're not a lib, you're an irrational conspiratorial kook. Speaker didn't argue that. And it's so cheap to say that marginalized people who voice opinions others are too complacent or afraid to voice because of potential loss of status are just irrational losers who must be wrong. I don't think that's what he said. And as she says, this guy basically says, I get funded and promoted by the establishment to shield their narratives. He didn't say anything of the sort. You say, that's how I interpreted everything you were saying. Yeah, I do believe that is how you interpreted it, but it has nothing to do with what he actually said. And according to Ashi, this speaker was saying, you're a naughty boy, a pariah, an outcast, a loser, a worthless, stupid person if you disagree with the government narrative. Not at all. I'm sure the speaker would point out all sorts of government narratives that are completely bogus. Okay, Gandalf, you had some points.
I mean, if you look at the nature of the arguments this speaker is advancing, they pretty much all are arguments from assertion and then mocking and belittling opponents without addressing their actual objections or subjecting himself to debate. So, I mean, he's just arguing from the prestige of perceived social status, his perceived dual personality as Janice faced as a rational skeptic and a upholder of liberal orthodoxy and, of course, everyone else is stupid or crazy or a kook. Or, like I said, where if you support gun rights and you question the government, of course, then you're going to be a Timothy McVeigh and blow up a federal building. I mean, that's not a logical argument at all. I mean, how many times does that guy, not make an argument from logic and always make an argument from assertion? It was like every other sentence. I mean, that just insults my intelligence on some level, what this guy was saying.
Okay, great. So I think I'm going to call it a night. Thanks, Gandalf, for coming on the show. So take care.
Thanks,
everyone. Good night.